crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
That stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up.
Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, blast off!
I got a laptop. I make music with my friends. I've got a laptop, baby. I make music with my friends. There it is.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
So, it's not rocket science, but that's why mad science exists, because somebody's got to say it. So anyway, it's not rocket science. We're going to go through a few things today. Hopefully you stick with me long enough to figure out what it is that I'm trying to say. You're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, this is the long part, Natalie. Gotta catch my air. By the way, I'm not alone. I got a non-scientist nice person here. Say hi.
Hi.
Hello! Anyway, so if you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html where you have access to not one, but four separate chat rooms. As well as if you scroll down on the Super Chat room, you can click on the People for People radio link. Say hi to all those nice folks over there. Hi.
Hello.
I see you. Hold on. Let me throw a smiley face in there, doggone it. Oh, I'm hitting the wrong buttons. That's the problem. It's like on the bridge of the Enterprise, man. So anyway, there's a smiley face for you, Red. All right. So anyway... So anyway, it's not rocket science, but you got all these people out there complaining about how terrible the world is and how, you know, we need to fix this and that. And so a couple, you know, mad science folks and everybody, I figure, could get it done if we really want to get to it. But, you know, nonetheless, we got to have somebody out there saying what's what. Otherwise, ain't nobody saying it. In our education system in today's day and age, as they like to say, it's dropped the ball. It's failed. You know, I think that the doggone science... No, that's not Kara. She comes next hour, or the next show. That's Natalie. Say hi.
Hello.
Yeah, that's... She don't talk much. once we get her started, she'll talk.
I'm here to learn.
Yeah. So, anyway... I lost my track, but either way, the education system out there, they really dropped the ball when it come down to science, because if people would have paid attention in basic science class and started engineering things from the get-go to use those laws of physics to your advantage and not to your disadvantage, then we wouldn't be talking about what cannot be done as opposed to what can be done. We'd be talking about getting things done, and we'd get things done. So anyway, I'm going to play this one podcast right here, and like I always do, I'm probably going to mouth off a few times. So check this out here. Let me see if I can get this going. Alrighty then. Pause that for a second while this crazy news is going. This is from the Shell Oil Company a long time ago about the diesel engine. But just listening in on this thing.
For most of us, living means working. So to get the most out of life, men look for a way of making machines do some of their work. We answer, but it was not always reliable. They turned to another form of energy, and discovering that heat could drive machines, they opened up a great new reservoir of reliable power. New industries were born and new towns built to serve them. The arrival of the heat engine changed the whole way of life for people in many parts of the world. The first practical heat engines were driven by steam. Fed on coal and water, they were the foundation of the new industrial age. Day and night they worked, pumping, driving, turning, consuming thousands of tons of coal. During the 19th century, coal was by far the best fuel available. It also yielded a valuable byproduct, gas for lighting and heating. But this gas was now used for another purpose. As a source of gas engine, patented Otto and Langen in 1860. For years, men had been trying to do away with boilers and to burn fuel inside the cylinder. Now, coal gas made this possible. But these early internal combustion engines were temperamental, and their power output was too limited to challenge the power of the steam engine. It was not until 1877 when Otto adapted the principles of the four-stroke cycle theory of the French scientist Beaudirache, that a really practical internal combustion engine was built. The Otto silent gas engine, as it was known, was the forerunner of all modern four-stroke engines. First stroke, induction. A mixture of gas and air is drawn into the cylinder. Second stroke, compression. Third stroke, power. The mixture is ignited and expands, driving the piston outwards. Fourth stroke, exhaust. With the discovery of petroleum, a new source of power was born, and the internal combustion engine developed rapidly. Similar in principle to the gas engine, the gasoline engine had the advantage of utilizing an easy-to-handle fuel. Thus, it was ideal for use in the motor car. In contrast to the gasoline engine, another type of internal combustion engine was built in 1890. Designed by Ackroyd Stewart, this machine was used for driving stationary power plants. It ran on a heavier petroleum fuel and was known as the hot bulb oil engine. The engine comprises a vaporizer, or hot bulb, from which the hot gases pass through a narrow passage into the working cylinder. In the cylinder is a piston joined by a connecting rod to the crankshaft and a heavy flywheel. Before starting, the vaporizer is heated by a blow lamp to high temperature. The flywheel is then turned over by hand.
Imagine starting your car like that.
Pure air is sucked into the working cylinder, and the oil fuel is sprayed into the hot bulb. During the second stroke, air and vaporized fuel are mixed together and compressed. The high temperature in the vaporizer causes combustion, and the piston is forced outward by the expanding gases. Finally, the burnt gases are expelled from the cylinder. Once the engine was running, the heat retained in the hot bulb was enough to ensure combustion, and the blow lamp was no longer necessary. These simple engines could run for long periods at a constant speed, and they gained a wide reputation for reliability. The 19th century saw enormous progress in the development of heat engines of all kinds, and towards its close, there were four main types in general use. The oil engine with hot bulb vaporizer, the steam engine, which was still considered supreme for a wide variety of uses, the gas engine for stationary power plants, and the rapidly improving gasoline engine. All these engines worked on the same basic principle of turning heat into work. But in each case, the amount of heat turned into work was small. The efficiency was low. 6% for the average steam engine. 10% for the oil engine, 17% for the gas engine, and 12% for the gasoline engine.
Okay, so there's like 6% for the oldest one, 10% for the next one in line, and 17%, and 12% efficiency for the most modern of those old deals. And we still, to this day, haven't exceeded 20 some odd percent efficiency on our cars. How's it feel knowing that most of the fuel that you put in your car, after paying all the money you pay for it, goes out the exhaust pipe?
Yeah, it feels kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, because, you know, out here in the real world, it takes a lot of money to survive. And so if you're putting $2 or $3 per gallon in your car, can you think of any other place that you could use that money?
So many.
Well, that's our biggest issue right there is efficiency. And so that's the reason why we're talking about heat today, because if you understand that any time you use energy, you generate heat. you know, via friction, or like if you compress a gas, that gas will get hot, you know, air compressor technology. If you've ever went over to a air compressor while it's running and you put your finger on the top of the head of the air compressor, you'll burn a blister the size of Texas on your finger. That is hot. That's a lot of heat. Now what if you could take that heat energy and store it for later use? So not only are you paying money at the gas pump, which we just said that only like 20 to maybe 30% max efficiency if your car's running top notch. Mm-hmm. But the rest of that percentage goes out the exhaust pipe. How's that make you feel?
Like a fool.
Well, these cars are really highly engineered, right? They got engineers out there that are trying to make them as incredibly efficient as possible. The truth of the matter, if the truth be known, they don't try to make them 100% efficient. Because if you can't get over 12% efficient in the oldest vehicle there, well, 6% in the oldest one, that was the steam engine, and then 10% for the oil engine, and then 17 for the gas engine. And when we say gas, we're talking like when they turn that coal, it's like gasification. When you heat up wood without no oxygen, it's basically carbon, so it will release gas that they call syngas, and that can be burned in an internal combustion engine. And so it'll run almost like your engine that's burning gasoline. Mm-hmm. But you're just using a different process. So there's four separate processes, but then the best one that they got on there, 12% efficiency from the old Model Ts to modern day efficiency being maybe 20, 30% max. So, that's an old message. Huh. So anyway, so if you're paying all that money at the fuel pump, and then when you go home after a hard day's work, you want to take a warm shower, and so all day long your hot water heater's been storing heat energy in it. But whenever that hot water heater is not efficient, then that means that heating element's coming on a lot. And that's taking your electric bill and spinning that little dial on there. So if you could take and capture some of that heat energy instead of sending that electric bill on, if your electric bill was like, let's say, $5 cheaper every month, can you think of any place to put that?
Yeah.
$5 a month in the bank saved on electricity. So, you know, it's the whole thing about bringing your efficiency up. The higher you can get your efficiency, the more resources you have as far as financial that you could save. Imagine getting 100% efficiency. And instead of just using your solar panels for making electricity, you could use your solar panels for heating up water and storing that heat energy for days when the sun wasn't shining.
Yeah.
If you have a large enough bank, you can store enough for 4 or 5 days of heat energy that, at the very least, your hot water heater never comes on. And since your hot water heater is a resistive load, it's got an element in there. I don't think I got one hanging around anywhere close, but anyway, it's got a resistive heat element inside there. And so it gets hot and transfers that heat to your water, and as long as your water heater is insulated really well, then that water will stay hot in there for a long time. But after a while, because of the way the heat transfer works, hot wants to go to cold. If your temperature in your room is just room temperature, like maybe you like to keep your house 60 degrees, that's obviously going to be colder than that water, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that heat energy is going to want to move that way. It's going to want to move off into your room. And then eventually when the temperature of the water gets down below whatever you got it set for, that element kicks on again. And there goes the money machine. Imagine if that never has to come on.
Yeah.
So you can use all the different systems that anywhere in your house where there's heat being generated by energy that you're using, you can move that energy and store it in your hot water tank. And your hot water tank's obviously only going to be able to hold so much heat energy. And so if you expanded on your hot water heater and you like maybe added 10 of them in line, might take longer to get them all hot, but that's all that more heat energy that you're able to store, which means that doggone hot water heater element is never coming on.
Yeah.
So that's just a let's keep on moving here. That's just a little tiny fraction of what we have the capabilities of doing. I'm going to play a bit more of this podcast.
Looking at these facts, Rudolf Diesel was certain that it should be possible to build an engine with a very much higher efficiency. Thart, he was convinced of four things. He must get away from the steam engine entirely. Combustion must take place inside the cylinder. Air, not steam, must be the working medium. And finally, the air must be highly compressed so as to permit the greatest possible expansion. He remembered the pneumatic match, or fire piston. A small cylinder, usually made of wood or glass, into which a closely fitting piston or plunger could be inserted. The head of the piston was recessed so as to hold a piece of dry tinder. When the air in the cylinder was highly compressed, it became so hot as to cause the tinder to ignite. The fire piston gave a clue to a practical means of securing combustion in...
Sometimes, in order to understand how to do stuff, you need to go back in time and see how they did it back then. What they just showed on there, folks, I posted these links to these videos in there, was basically, if you can imagine a test tube and a plunger that goes down into that test tube, when that air compressed, it generated heat, and then when you pulled it back out and the oxygen hit it, it ignited the fuel source at the end of that piston. So, that was a lighter. Before, that didn't take any gas whatsoever. It just used whatever dry tinder you could put on the end of that, like a little cotton ball or something like that. But did you see how simple that compressed?
Yeah.
Got hot.
Inside the cylinder. Compression. Ignition. Diesel adapted this principle to the internal combustion engine and described the cycle for the first time in 1892. A downward stroke of the piston. Pure air is sucked into the cylinder. The air is then compressed to the point where it reaches the temperature necessary for combustion. Fuel is introduced into the compressed air. Owing to the high temperature, it takes fire and produces heat, which is turned into work. During the fourth stroke, the spent gases are forced out of the cylinder. The first experimental engine was built at Augsburg in Germany during 1893. Most people were convinced that no machine would work at the high pressures which Diesel insisted were necessary for combustion and essential for high thermal efficiency.
Los, Riemen einrücken.
Engine never ran under its own power. One of the main problems facing Diesel arose from the high pressure inside the cylinder. an exact quantity of oil fuel had he sprayed finely and accurately through a dense wedge of compressed air. It was found that the fuel pump by itself could not do the job effectively. So an air pump was added, which could blow the fuel into the combustion chamber. The principle was similar to that of a perfume atomizer. The method was known as air blast injection. By 1894, a completely new and redesigned engine had been built, and preparations were complete for the first trial run.
It's funny to see how big, bulky, and clumsy those things were back then.
In spite of this setback, an all-important fact had been demonstrated. Compression ignition was a practical way of securing combustion, and an engine could be made to work on this cycle. By 1897, the first reliable engine had completed its tests. Limitations in engineering methods had made some modifications necessary. Nevertheless, the engine had an efficiency of 27%. Far higher than any other engine of the day. By the turn of the century, the diesel engine was in regular production. The first models built under license were large single-cylinder units with a maximum speed of less than 200 revolutions per minute. Manufacturers in various countries made some modifications to the original design, and a few horizontal engines were built. These were reminiscent of Aykroyd Stewart's earlier engine, but with much higher compression and no hot bulb. The diesel was ideal for driving electric generators. With the rapid expansion of electrical power, there was a demand for larger engines with more than one cylinder. With the development of more power, engineers soon realized that the diesel could be adapted for marine work. By 1912, the first ocean-going diesel ship had been built.
Of that one right there, but if you listen to that guy when he's talking about the first diesel engine, it was 27% efficient. So you would think that over the time we would have been able to get better, but a modern gasoline engine, according to the Google search, Modern gasoline engines have a maximum thermal efficiency of 20 to 35% when used to power a car. Isn't that crazy? So all these years they couldn't get that efficiency up. Do you know what efficiency translates to?
No.
Well, for you it'd be more money in your purse. For me it'd be more money in my wallet. My pocket, don't matter. I don't carry money in my wallet in case somebody picks my pocket. They ain't getting my money.
That's smart.
Yeah, so I keep it in my safe. But anyway, it's just the fact that they don't seem to understand. If you're understanding what basic science and you read the definition, it tells you right there maximum thermal efficiency. it all relies on heat. Those engines back in those days were turning fuel into heat, and heat into the energy necessary to move things. You know, whereas the windmills reliant on the wind to blow, or the solar panels, the sun to shine, all that kind of stuff there. They were transferring fuel of any type into heat energy and then turn it into electricity with generators. So here we are in the year 2019, and we can only get maximum 35% efficiency out of an internal combustion engine. You see anything wrong with that?
So many things.
But can you think of any reason why they wouldn't want more efficiency on anything, whether it be your appliances that you're using at home or your vehicle that you use to get to and fro work?
I mean, it's like we talked about earlier. I think, someone's making money off the fact that that's not as efficient as it could be.
Yeah, that's the whole entire deal. It's like the planned obsolescence of a light bulb. A lot of folks don't realize that a light bulb is, if you look on the package, it'll tell you how many hours this light bulb's good for.
Right.
So why is it that there are other people out there who have made light bulbs back in the late 1800s that still work today? Think about it. Planned obsolescence means it has to fail. So they're going to make your car where this parts is going to have to break down.
Right. I mean, you're going to have to spend more money on it over time. You're going to have to replace a light bulb. You know, if this light bulb goes out, you're going to replace it because you need to have light in here to do what you're doing.
Yeah.
And they know that.
But if you have the capability of making a light bulb that will last over 100 and some odd years, then why wouldn't you want to make a light bulb that will last over 100 and some? Because you want to sell light bulbs.
Right.
Or if you want to sell electricity, you make it as inefficient as you can get by with, because now we got to be, energy savers, right? This is a whole carbon thing. We don't want too much carbon in the air and that stuff, even though carbon is what feeds the plants. So, anyway, we don't want plant food in the air, so we are trying to cut back on electricity usages. Well, here we are in the year 2019 once again, and electricity hasn't changed since the late 1800s. It's still the same thing, and the efficiency hasn't changed, with maybe just the exception of the fraction. Like, for example, they said that one diesel engine was 27% efficient. That means all the fuel you burn, you get 20%, so 27% of that power out to get the work done. And here we are moving forward to modern day, and one of them's actually 20% to 35%. So one of them's less efficient than it was. That old junker that we was looking at that blew up.
We're going the wrong way.
Yeah. But if they couldn't have learned more, I mean, it's not rocket science. You know that heat is going to be one of the byproducts of any energy usage. And so, heat's what you need for that combustion. So, why couldn't you store that heat energy and reuse that heat energy like the diesel engine does? The diesel engine has what's called a glow plug on it. And you use electricity from the battery, and it lights this glow plug up, which is a little resistive element. And it gets really red hot, kind of like that little cigarette lighter in your car. You push it in and it heats that element up and gets really red hot. Never put your thumb on it, even if it's gray, because it might still be working. I tried that once. It didn't look like it was working. But it was working. But either way, the glow plug, it heats up the inside of that cylinder to get that cylinder ready for the compression ignition. So it's a preheater for the diesel engine. And once that engine's up to operating temperature, they monopolized on the heat that is generated by the pistons going up and down and the compressed air inside the cylinder. All that generates heat, and so once they got that engine up to operating temperature, they never had to use the glow plug again until the next time they wanted to start it. So that means it became more efficient because now you don't, like on your gasoline engine, you got a spark plug, which ignites the fuel inside there. And there's two different types of burns. One is like it just burns, and in your gasoline engine, it's more like a little explosion. That's a simple way to understand it. But either way, with the gasoline engine, that means you have to have a battery in order to run the electricity necessary to ignite that fuel. And had they would have done the same thing that diesel, have you ever like went and shut your car off and your car just wouldn't stop? It wouldn't stop running, it was doing that clunk, 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 clunk. Yeah, that's called dieseling. That's when your engine got too hot and it's still, the fuel is still igniting.
It wants to keep going.
It won't shut off.
I don't care
off.
If I don't have any battery power. I'm going to keep going.
Well, either way, you know, there's things to be learned from all these different types of engines, like the diesel engine. And diesel engines are really good for generators because of the way that fuel actually acts as a lubricant on the piston. So you can, you're not supposed to idle a gasoline engine for long periods of time because it's not getting enough lubrication to those cylinders, and you can wear out your pistons and your rings and your cylinder for running that engine too long because it gets too hot. It reaches its thermal breakdown and starts to fail. Whereas a diesel engine, you can let these things run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, because the fuel is quite literally oil. So it's getting lubricated while you're sitting there running it.
That makes sense.
And so if you was going to build a home generator system, then you want to be able to maximize that efficiency, then you do something similar to what they do in school buses. I talked to you a bit while we were off air, remember, about how your car recovers some of the heat energy?
Yeah.
Through the heater during the winter time. Well, that heat energy could also be used to make air conditioning as well, because you can use the physics of heat expansion, contraction, and the way that energy thermally transfers from one place to the next. Once you understand those basic physics. But either way, imagine your home diesel engine, and then you use, going back in time where they used to use old radiator systems in order to heat your house, so the water jacket on that diesel engine now becomes your heater for your house during the winter time. And the better insulated that motor is, it could be sub-zero weather outside, and you would still be able to transfer what would have otherwise been a loss, and that would raise that efficiency of what that engine used to be. So if I say to you that in the wintertime, a school bus is more efficient than in the summertime, you see how that would happen?
Yeah.
Because now you're taking some of that what would have been waste energy, and you're using it. So it's only waste if you're not using it. During the wintertime, during the summertime, you've got so much heat going on, you got to get rid of it so it goes out into the atmosphere, and you got to try to, if you're lucky, run an air conditioner in order to be able to keep cool inside the car.
Right.
But you could turn that heat energy into cold air. When something heats up, it expands. The air around it just expands, and so that would cause compression, which would actually cause even more heat if it was in a container. Mm-hmm. When you allow that gas to expand rapidly, and the air around us is a gas, so when you allow that air to expand rapidly into something that's got a temperature difference, that heat exchange will occur, and it will instantaneously get cold. That's how that air conditioner works, which I better shut off because it's probably... You hear all that racket in the background, folks. That's because I forgot to turn the AC off. It's a live mic. So, anyway, by taking using the physics of heat and cold, you can become more efficient. Like right now, 35% efficient during the winter time. Like I said, it's going to be a lot more efficient during the winter time because the average engine in your car will run anywhere from 160 to 220 degrees Fahrenheit. That's hot.
Yeah.
If you don't get rid of that heat, that engine will literally destroy itself. Everything has a thermal breakdown point at which it will fail. And once it reaches its thermal breakdown, the material will get soft, and whatever harder material that it's rubbing up against, that friction will start tearing that thing apart. That's why you got to have oil in your car. But if you specifically engineered that engine to move that heat away faster than it could build up, then that means that those parts, even without oil, would never fail. They'd never be able to reach their thermal breakdown if you could take that doggone heat energy away faster than it could build up. You could make that engine to where it would never fail. Most of everything that gets broke is because it got too hot. Electric motors, the insulation on the wires, they get too hot and the insulation fails, and instead of 1,000 turns of wire, now you're down to 1 turn and it's a dead short, and you'll blow your breaker out trying to run it or start a wire fire. But if you could keep that thing cool, then you would never have to worry about it. Most of the reasons why electric fans fail is because nobody ever cleans the back out. And so there ain't no air circulating. You know, when the fan is blowing one direction, all that dirt is plugging it up. And it's causing that electric motor to get hotter.
Mm-hmm.
It's not rocket science. It's just basic science and understanding a little bit about physics of how heat energy works and friction and all that kind of stuff. So in the energy industry, they're trying to figure out ways to store heat, which let me see if I'll find the right one here. There's a gentleman that's on YouTube that I think he's doing something similar to that. Let's try this one out.
I love solar energy. The idea that you can just put this panel out in the sun and it creates electricity for you is phenomenal. But you need a way to store that energy. Now, I built this lithium battery bank behind me out of a used Chevy Volt car. But even this used battery pack was very expensive at $2,000. So today, we're going to talk about a much cheaper, simpler, and much more old-fashioned way of storing energy. That's just with hot water. So here we go. So what I'm trying to do on my site with my family is generate my own power, store my own power, and use my own power, and be independent from the power grid. In several of my past videos where I've been talking about an ongoing experiment between the solar photovoltaic and the solar thermal, I've received a lot of comments from you guys suggesting that I just use a heat pump water heater. Now, a heat pump water heater is kind of like an air conditioner bolted on top of a large tank of water, say 50 or 80 gallons. While this makes a lot of sense for people who are on grid, I don't think it makes a lot of sense for me where I want to go off grid. You need to think about your days of autonomy, or how many cloudy days in a row do you expect, reasonably, before you get another sunny day and these bad boys recharge your batteries. Where I live, in Massachusetts State, I'm usually looking at 3 or 4 cloudy days in a row that I'm planning my storage around.
Right,
a heat pump water heater is usually a 50-60...
Solar panels are really inefficient as well. And one of the things that makes solar panels inefficient, what do you think it is?
don't know.
Heat. Imagine while those solar panels are getting hot, the process that's actually producing electricity has to work harder to get past that heat. But if you're able to take those that heat off the back of that solar panel and use that heat elsewhere to guide that energy somewhere, you keep those solar panels cooler, then you raise the efficiency of those solar panels. And even in the transfer of that energy from the solar panel to the batteries, anytime you use energy, you're going to generate heat. Moving the energy from the solar panels to the battery, there's some sort of resistance in there that's going to also pick up heat. From the battery to your inverters, it changes your AC current, or your DC current to AC, so you can run things like your computers and stuff like that. There are systems in there that have to have fans because otherwise they will too get hot. So from every step, from the solar panel to the electric system that's taking the energy downstream, to the batteries, to the inverters, and even into your appliances, there are portions to where those would be classified as losses in the system because you're generating heat, and heat would radiate out into the air and it would just be wasted. But if you can guide that energy from every single stage towards your hot water heater, now you got a hot water heater that the element never has to kick on. And what this guy is talking about is storing that heat energy for days at a time, because if you understand how heat transfer works, then that's how a heat pump system or an air conditioner or whatever, that the heat transfer, you would be able to use as stored energy just by knowing something simple, that it heat goes to cold all the time. And once those two temperatures become the same, then that process stops. There's a thermal siphon that if you heat this side over here and there's a temperature difference in the water over here, it will actually circulate that water by itself without no electricity, without no pump. They use this in emergency systems in nuclear power plants in Japan. In case the power goes off, then they can still get cold water to the hot reactor. What do you think? It's mind-blowing, right?
Man, yeah.
All right, here we go.
80 or 80-gallon tank of hot water. Now, that that volume of hot water is not going to be able to last my family for 3 or 4 days in a row. Now, knowing that, it means that I would have to increase the size of the batteries in order to store the electrical energy that's needed to run the compressor for all those cloudy days in a row. But you know what? These lithium batteries, these are expensive. Even my used batteries at $2,000, these are over $140 per kilowatt hour of energy. So if we can instead just store enough hot water to get us through all those cloudy days, this can potentially be a lot less money. So thermal energy storage in the form of hot water makes a whole lot of sense. And that's one of the reasons that I'm running this extended experiment right now between the solar photovoltaic and the solar thermal.
Pause this for a second. One of the things I was talking to you about off air was about hydrogen technology, you know, water being a really awesome fuel. It's also a battery, because you can store, when you get those little water molecules shaking around like that, well, that, you know, that's energy. And so you can store this if you keep it in like the thermos that we talked about. But if you want to generate yet even more energy from that water, all you have to know is a few little simple things on how to separate the hydrogen and oxygen and then use that water as fuel. So your solar panel that's running during the daytime could actually be running a little circuitry that would send the equivalence of a radio wave in through this water and separate the hydrogen and oxygen. One of the things that you get as a byproduct of doing that is heat. You'll also get pressure, because when water is separated, when water's boiled, water will boil at 212 degrees Fahrenheit at sea level. After that, you know, it starts to evaporate. Well, that evaporation process causes that to do a massive expansion, like something like 1,600 times its volume. So if you've got a little bitty water about that big, you imagine 1,600 times its volume, and that's how steam pressure does the work that it does, because when you turn it from water into steam, it's pressing out, it's expanding. Anytime you get something hot, it expands. So this process that he's talking about storing, it doesn't even scratch the surface of the capabilities if you understood how powerful that water molecule really is. All you got to do is understand the physics of it. You know, water is as a liquid, you can't compress it. And so you could use it as hydraulic fluid. You know, like in your brakes, when you push your foot on the brake, it squirts this fluid down and it hits the diaphragm and pushes your brakes apart. That's hydraulics. Well, the same thing. You could actually use water in that system, as long as it don't, use a material that doesn't rust fast. Oxidize.
Yeah.
It won't. Your brakes won't rot out on you. That's why we use some sort of oil. But nonetheless, the physics is there, because the liquid can't be compressed. But once you expand it, now you're talking about a whole different thing. Now you can compress it once it's a gas.
This is a fairly simple concept. You heat up a lot of water. You insulate it really well. And then you'll still have hot water a few days later. That makes sense. I love it. Now, exactly what is the math? And I do like math. We need a starting point. And what is that? Well, to me, that would be a minimum temperature water of 120 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's actually the limit of what my state allows hot water tanks to be set at. Anything higher than that, and you need a thermostatic mixing valve. Now, I actually have this downstairs in my crawl space right now, because my thermal storage tank can be hotter than 120 degrees. Well, my thermal storage tank down in my crawl space is what we call atmospherically vented, or you could also call it just non-pressurized. There is no pressure that can be stored in that tank. Coming out of the shower head, you want pressurized water. So how do you have a pressure water system get heat from a non-pressure system? Well, the answer is that you use a heat exchanger. Down in my crawl space, that is a 300-foot coil of PEX tubing. Now, this PEX tubing actually makes for a pretty decent heat exchanger. But, full disclosure, if I was to do this again, I would actually switch it over to a copper coil. Inside the heat exchanger is the pressurized potable water, which just means it's the drinking water that comes out the taps. Outside of that, just in the regular vessel, that water does not get replaced or replenished. That water just sits there for the life of the tank and is a thermal battery. Just like the chemicals that are inside this lithium battery, they don't get replaced. Just the electrons move in and out, right? Just like in a thermal battery, the heat energy moves in and out. Now, the last piece of the puzzle to remember when you're working with a heat exchanger is that the thermal battery, the large storage tank of hot water, it needs to be hotter than the water that you want coming out of your tap. So if you want 120 degree Fahrenheit water coming out your tap, the thermal battery needs to be hotter than that. Now, this has to do with the heat transfer rate and how big is the heat exchanger, what the flow rate of the water is. But just to keep it simple for the sake of the video, let's say you need a 10 degree delta or 10 degree difference in temperature between the thermal storage tank and the water that you want coming out. So in this example, we're going to set the bare minimum temperature of that thermal water 130 degrees Fahrenheit. If we can always stay above that, we're good. Then we can talk about what's the high limit. So we don't want the water to boil and turn to steam. So we want to keep it under 212. But is that really the working limit? Well, the working limit of a thermal storage tank is probably lower. In my case, the working limit of my tank is 180 degrees Fahrenheit because I have an EPDM rubber liner and I have PEX tubing as my heat exchanger. All right, cool. So we know that 180 degrees is our high point and 130 is our low point. The difference between them is 50 degrees Fahrenheit. So 50 degrees is our delta. Awesome. Now let's move on to the next phase. Now I'm going to start talking about BTUs, or British Thermal Units, because I'm in the United States and that's just what we use here. The heat capacity of water is 8.33 BTUs per gallon per degree Fahrenheit. Now we've already established that our thermal battery, our big water tank, has a 50 degree delta of temperature, of degrees Fahrenheit. Now that means that for every gallon of water, we can store 416.5 BTUs. Then we can ask the question, how much energy do you actually need? Well, for my own family, I recorded our energy use just on hot water over the course of a year. We're at almost 24,000 BTUs per day. All right, cool. In addition to knowing how many BTUs are going to be pulled out of that tank because of our heat exchanger and our use, we also need to know what is our heat loss. If our tank is made out of this styrofoam, well, there's only a certain thickness to this. And this styrofoam is only so good. It's not perfect. So this is going to lose some of its heat energy through the walls to the surrounding environment. And it's going to do that all the time. So how do we calculate for that heat loss? Now, the rate of heat loss is going to vary depending on the temperature of the water inside the tank and the temperature of the surrounding environment. So we're going to have to make a few assumptions to work this out. But, you know, we're working with really big numbers here. So just go with me on this one.
All right, I'm going to pause that just for a second. The materials that used for insulation are even getting better. They've actually got thermal gels out there right now that you could put your hand on one side. They call it like aerogel or something like that. And you can have a blowtorch on the opposite side, and that heat will not transfer to your hand. So if with modern day materials, using these simple physics, you could get that water battery to literally store heat energy almost indefinitely. As long as there's no place for that energy to go, then it's not going to, you know, leak out into the atmosphere, so to speak. So with that said, I know this kind of might be a little bit boring as far as the numbers goes, but it's really important because the math is backing up what this man says.
So let's say that the average air temperature around the tank is 65 degrees and the average temperature inside the tank is 155. Well, now we have a 90 degree delta difference in temperature. Now, if we take the case of my own personal tank that I've built down in the crawl space, we have a area of 90 square feet around the all six sides. And it's insulated with two layers of polyiso foam board. The lid has a third, but let's just keep it to two, make it nice and easy right now. So that's a total of R26 all the way around with the 90 square feet. Well, if we actually take the inverse of that R value, we'll come up with the U factor, which is 0.03, oh, what is it? It's a long digit here. That U factor is 0.03846. So if we multiply that by the area and by the difference in temperature, and then you also multiply that by 24 hours in a day, and we come up with a heat loss out of that tank, and we come up with a heat loss out of that tank of 7,400 BTUs per day. So if we add the heat loss out of the tank to the heat loss that we'll be drawing from the tank for heating our water, then we need a total of 31,300 and 60 BTUs per day. If we multiply that by however many days of autonomy you want, or cloudy weather days in a row, I'm going to use 4 for this example, then we need 125,000 BTUs stored inside the tank. Now, if we...
All right, so I want to go back to that insulation deal, that aerogel that is modern-day insulator. Like I said, you could put a blowtorch on one side and you could put your hand on the other and it will not allow that heat to transfer. So you can imagine the same storage system. This would raise the efficiency of his math yet even farther if he had access to this type of material to surround any portion that the temperature could actually exchange to where he doesn't want it to go, which is basically out into the room or the atmosphere. So the numbers that he's talking about right here would be a whole lot better with an insulation like that. And there are all kinds of different good insulations with really high R factors on there that, you know, resist that temperature exchange and, you know, will hold in basically like a thermos. What do you think?
I left for 2 seconds and there was a lot of math going on.
Yeah.
And I got a little behind. I'm going to try to play catch up real quick.
Well, he's calculating it out how much water he would actually have in his system and how long it would be able to last him for like 3 or 4 days after, you know, if it was cloudy and his solar panels weren't generating power. So he'd be able to store heat energy for that long period of time until the sun came back out again.
Go back to our heat capacity of the tank and look at our gallons, and we're going to come up with 301 gallons of water that need to be stored in that tank. Now, my particular tank is 250 gallons, so I'm not there. I'm probably good up to 3 days of autonomy, but on the fourth day, not so much. Now, when I built my storage tank down in the crawl space, I just used a lot of stuff that I had on hand. But if you're going to go and buy all the material new, it would probably cost you about $300 in supplies. So my storage tank, being 250 gallons, I can store just over 100,000 BTUs. Now, if you were to create that heat energy using just an electric resistance element, that is the equivalent of 30.5 kilowatt hours. Now remember, this battery bank is 14.3 kilowatt hours. So if you go and you build a 250 gallon storage tank for $300 and you can store just over 100,000 BTUs, that's the equivalent of having more than 2 of these. And remember, I paid $2,000 for one. So that's the equivalent of $4,000 worth of batteries that you'd have to buy. You can build that tank for $300. So that actually means that if you translate that all into kilowatt hours, then instead of spending $143 per kilowatt hour for these lithiums, in a thermal storage bank, you're actually paying just $10 per kilowatt hour, or 7% of the cost. Now that is so cheap that it's just ridiculous. So I just love the idea that you can store several days worth of hot water in heat energy in a large, well-insulated thermal battery bank. Now if you oversize your thermal tank, that could potentially be bad if you can't heat the water to the temperature that you want. But assuming that you can get it up to the temperature you want, an oversized tank can be a benefit to you because you could also then use it for things like space heating. Which I need a lot of, being in Massachusetts.
Yeah, and it probably gets really...
So I hope that helps you understand why I love the idea that when the sun is shining, go ahead and make the electrical energy stored in batteries, also make the thermal energy and store it in hot water, and do both. And that's part of the reason for my big experiment here and why I care so much about how I can most efficiently and cost-effectively take solar energy and produce 180 degree Fahrenheit water. You know, I mean, because if I can take my big giant tank of water and heat it up to 180 degrees, that'll swing me through for the, you know, for the next 4 days of cloudy weather. And that's awesome. Thank you guys so much for watching. I hope you enjoyed the video. So please like, subscribe, and leave your questions and comments below. Thanks a lot for watching.
Cool. All right, so we're going to move up to there to get to, if I can find it, a little physics lesson. If I can find the right one. Let's try this one right here first.
We all want to save money heating and cooling our house or office, right? The answer may be under your feet, literally. Much of the heating and cooling can come from the ground, below the surface, with something called a geothermal heat pump. You see, below the frost line, about 10 feet down, the Earth maintains a nearly constant temperature of 54 degrees. We can tap into this energy to provide heating in the winter and cooling in the summer. Okay, now here's how it works. Bury a loop of pipes, called a heat exchanger, just below the surface, and fill them with water or a water and antifreeze solution. During the winter months, the air is usually cooler than the temperature below ground. The solution circulates in a loop underground and absorbs the Earth's heat. This heat is brought to the surface and transferred to a heat pump. The heat pump warms the air, and then your regular heating system warms the air some more to a comfortable temperature. Finally, ducts circulate the air to the various rooms. Now, a huge benefit is that the geothermal system doesn't have to work as hard to make people inside comfortably warm, and you save lots of money on your heating bill. In the summertime, the system works in reverse. When it's hot outside, the temperature below the surface is cooler than the summer heat. So, the fluid in the loop absorbs heat in the building and sends it underground. The ground's lower temperature cools it, and it's circulated again and again. Now you're saving money on air conditioning. Now, this church uses a large geothermal heat pump to heat and cool the building. It has a very big parking lot, which lets it spread out its loop horizontally. But if you don't have all that space, you can go straight down and use a vertical loop system instead. Geothermal heat pumps can be used just about anywhere in the U.S. because all areas have nearly constant shallow ground temperatures, although systems in different locations will have varying degrees of efficiency and cost savings. The constant temperature of the Earth just below our feet is a sustainable resource, literally in our own backyard. It's a clean energy source ready for us to use to heat and cool our homes and buildings while lowering our utility bills.
So, what I would have to ask is why that particular setup isn't in every single household out there already. You're running your AC during the summertime, and you're running your heat during the wintertime, and because of those temperature differences, that same exact system that in the cold temperature will bring heat into your house, and in the hot temperature outside will bring cool air into your house. That would make your furnace or your AC unit or your heat pump system, whichever one you've got, more efficient just by adding that supplementary system. Why don't they do that, you think?
Because someone's making money off of the fact that we're not doing that.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying, man.
Demand sell electricity wants to sell you electricity. The man selling the man fuel to run his generators to sell you the electricity, he wants to make money. So it's all back to the dollar bill. You find out where that dollar bill is, and you'll know who and why. That's the whole deal right there. But if people, if the average Joe starts to understand how simple all these physics and science are, and start implementing them into their system, at the very least, if you become incredibly efficient as to how you run your energy in your household, then you're going to save a lot of money. Instead of paying a high electric bill regardless of whether it's hot or cold outside, You can use all these physics to maximize the efficiency, even if you're burning wood in a stove. You know, science says energy can neither be created nor destroyed, so where does it go? All we're doing is moving it from one place to the next. Nature always tries to find a balance in there somewhere. Right? Once nature balances everything out, that process will stop. But if you understand those processes and you can keep it off constantly off of balance, the temperature difference under the ground as opposed to the temperature outside, and one's going to send you heat during the time when it's cold outside, which seems that's what you need, right? It's brilliant. And the other one's going to send you AC during the other portion of the time when it's cold, or vice versa. So those systems... battery storage systems, anything that you could do to store energy to make it so that your appliances don't ever have to come on. Imagine your air conditioner never comes on and you're staying cool. Mm-hmm. There's an old technique that people don't know a lot about, but because of how temperature works, how heat exchange works, you can bury a 30-foot culvert pipe 6 feet under the ground. And so the temperature in that pipe is going to be cooler than the hot air outside, and so that air difference is going to actually cause that air underneath the ground to draft and push it up into your house, and you have air conditioning without having any kind of compressor or electricity. Now, if you want to maximize the efficiency of it, you can actually put a fan in front of it and slowly draft that air through. When that hot air hits that cold underneath the ground, it will condense and there'll be water down inside there. And as that evaporation occurs, it's going to lower that temperature down yet even more, and you'll get an evaporative cooling up inside your house. All with no electricity. So, the whole entire concept of being able to save money is basically to stick it to the man. The power company and the fuel industries. That's why mad science is so important. What do you think?
I mean, it's just crazy. No one's talking about this. You know what I mean? It's insane.
Well, everybody always saying that they're broke. Yeah, I spent my last $2 at the gas pump.
Well, that's because your engine's only getting 20% efficiency.
Yeah. And so the same thing when it applies when you pay your electric bill. Most folks don't understand those little wall adapters that you leave plugged in, they still have a transformer in there. And even when you're not drawing power off of them, the transformer's still being used. And so you're drawing power even when you're not, when your phone's not plugged in.
Yeah.
So you're wasting electricity when you don't need to be. So if you just buy unplugging those things, you know, put them on one switch so that when you go to bed at night you're not charging anything, then shut the dang thing off. And so that's less electricity that you're using. But even if you are going to use them, with a few engineering tricks, you could turn that thermal heat loss, which is what happens when that little transformer is just sitting there, you know, charging something or even not charging it, the AC current's still coming to that primary coil on that transformer, and so it's generating heat. It's just sitting there getting hot. So next time you see one of those little adapters like that, that they ain't got nothing plugged into it, put your finger on there, and you'll see it's hot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know if my phone charger's plugged in overnight, it'll get hot to the little box.
That's thermal energy being wasted. But if you was using that thermal energy to move that heat somewhere else, you just made that efficiency better. Even though you're not charging your phone with it, it's still generating heat.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is what, if you could get, Scotty Sovereign said, who's that with Shaz? Say hi, Natalie.
Hello.
This is my son's lady.
That's me.
Yeah. So... reason why, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand this, and this is why Natalie's joined the show today, because she don't really understand, you know, the high-tech portion of science, but that doesn't mean she's stupid. It just means that if I can explain it in a simple concept, then You get it, right?
Yeah, I mean, that two and a half minute video that you just played showed me more than I ever knew about. Like, I didn't know about any of this.
Yeah.
And that 2.5 minute video made so much sense. Like,
yeah, we can even, like what I've shown you before we ever even came on the radio, was that you can actually guide light energy to where you want it. You know, those folks are putting the 2-liter bottle up in the ceiling so that the sunlight beats that, hits that, and then lights up. It's like the equivalence of a 60 or an 80 watt light bulb, depending, you know, on how the sun's shining that day.
Mm-hmm.
But that means one less light bulb in your house. Imagine if your whole house was set up with basically the equivalence of fiber optics, because you can run fiber optic cable in any direction. You got light coming on this side right here. You can bring it around the corner, and there'll be light in the other room.
Mm-hmm.
No electricity. It's just guiding that energy where you want it to go. And so, by doing that, you maximize your efficiency. During the daytime, like, it's daylight outside, and we got lights going.
Yeah.
Why? You know, we could turn it, we could, you know, open up the window shade and have light come in then that way, or we could actually use that type of system for like a skylight system and bring light in and not have to pay for that. So we're living like, you know, kings and queens, because we got electricity. You know, all we got to do is run over here and turn the switch on. But what it is actually enslaving us, because now we owe the man. And if you don't pay the man, guess what they do?
They shut everything off.
So essentially that's what you got. Scotty Sovereign said, hi, Natalie.
Hello.
So
welcome to crazy.
Yeah, that's
it reminds me of, it's not exactly the same thing, but have you seen those videos of the kids that'll, in other countries, I won't even try to guess what country, but, you know, where they're digging, like, a big pool with just, like, the most simple tools, and they'll make something, like, super cool and extravagant and with essentially nothing.
Yeah.
And it kind of reminds me of that. I mean, you could...
And they used you know, physics, which is, you know, the forces of gravity to bring water from way out.
Right.
And then fill them pools up. So they got, right, like, waterfalls and everything. And if they wanted to get even more high-tech, they could make little water wheels that would turn and generate electricity.
Yeah. I mean, it's... And all they're using is some shovels and some sticks to dig out, you know.
Well, I love watching those shows like that. I actually subscribe to a couple of those channels, and you'd be surprised at how much work that one man can mm-hmm. do. It's mind-blowing. So, you know, that's what this is all about. Doggone, I'm having a crazy time with that one chat room there. Anyway, if you can maximize your efficiency, number one, you're going to save money. And that makes it a resource. That money could then in turn be used to, you know, put into something else. And so with that said, let's go into a little bit more physics here. Thermodynamics.
This little toy is called a drinking bird. You put a cup of water in front of it, and its head dunks into the cup. Eventually, the head bobs up again, but then it goes right back into the water. If you don't know much about thermodynamics, the drinking bird might seem like it could go on forever without an external source of energy powering it. A perpetual motion machine, in other words. But the toy isn't a perpetual motion machine, because perpetual motion is impossible, according to the laws of physics. One of the reasons is the first law of thermodynamics.
Okay, let's pause this for a second. See, that's kind of a misnomer where they say perpetual motion is not possible because of all the losses that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But what if you could maximize on what would have been a loss and guide that energy around to where you want it to go? And as far as I'm concerned, even if you had to use a supplementary system such as a solar heater or something like that, then you could get it through the ports where the energy would have started falling off. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's like they say the sun's been going for how many billions of years? At what point is it classified as free energy? If you're not paying for it. Unless you live in California, they probably charge you tax for a solar panel.
No joke.
Oh, shoot. Anyway, let's keep going here.
One of the main goals of thermodynamics is to describe the transfer of energy. We've already described two processes as a transfer of energy, work and heat, and they're both connected to each other. As a thermodynamic system does work, it loses heat. When work is done on a system, it gains heat. So heat is converted to work, and work is converted to heat. Together, the work and heat transferred into or out of the system represent the change in its internal energy, which, as you might recall, is the total kinetic energy and potential energy of all the molecules in the system. This idea that the change in internal energy is equal to the change in work plus heat is so fundamental that it's known as the first law of thermodynamics. So we can have an equation to use for analysing problems. We write the first law like this. The internal energy, U, of a closed system is equal to Q, the heat transferred to the system, minus W, the work done on or by the system. It's important to remember that when we talk about changes in internal energy, if heat is transferred into the system, Q is positive, and if heat is transferred out of the system, Q is negative. And if work is done on the system, W is negative, and if work is done by the system, W is positive. Some textbooks will change those signs around, so it's worth keeping track of what the positives and negatives mean. Now you'll notice that the first law of thermodynamics describes only those two factors, work and heat, as affecting a change in internal energy. That's because as long as the system is closed, meaning it's isolated from the rest of the universe, there just aren't any other factors involved. The amount of heat lost by the system is exactly equal to the amount of work done by the system, and vice versa. So really, the first law of thermodynamics is just another way to describe the conservation of energy, which keeps coming up in our lessons because it's such a key principle of physics. There's always some kind of heat loss, like through friction. Even that tiny amount means that the motion can't continue forever. It will eventually run out of the energy it needs to drive the work it's doing. That's part of why the drinking bird isn't a perpetual motion machine. It relies on the energy it gets from the cup of water to power its movement. The bird is filled with a fluid that has a low boiling point, so it can easily change from a gas to a liquid and back, with just a slight change in temperature. There's some liquid at the bottom and some vapour at the top. When the bird's head dips into the cup, it gets wet. It keeps bobbing back and forth for a while, and as the water evaporates, it cools the vapour in the bird's head, which condenses into liquid, creating a partial vacuum in the head. That makes liquid travel up the tube. The head gets heavier and dips back into the water. But the tipping makes a bubble rise through the liquid into the bird's head, sending more liquid into the bottom, and setting the little bird swinging and starting the cycle all over again. But it still needs the water for it to do its thing. Once the water in the cup runs out, the bird stops moving. Now, there are four basic types of processes where the thermodynamic properties of a system, generally an ideal gas in some kind of container, can change according to the first law. In each case, one property is held constant, volume, pressure, temperature or heat, while the other properties change. Variations on all these properties are used in all kinds of machines, especially engines. First, there are isovolumetric processes where the volume is held constant, usually because the gas is in a rigid container, while heat is added or removed. As you add heat, the pressure of the gas will increase and so will its temperature. As you remove heat, the pressure and temperature would decrease. Isovolumetric processes are kind of boring as thermodynamic processes go. The gas is stuck inside its container, and no matter how much heat you add, the gas doesn't do any work. You're just increasing its internal energy. But isobaric processes, where the pressure is held constant while heat is added or removed, are a little more interesting. Here, the volume of the container is allowed to change, usually because the gas can move a piston. As you add heat, the volume and temperature of the system increase, and as you remove heat, the volume and temperature decrease, which means that an isobaric process can do work. Here's why. In earlier episodes, we said that work is equal to force times distance. In this case, the distance the piston moves. We've also said that pressure is equal to force divided by area, which means that force is equal to pressure times area. Here is the pressure of the gas times the area of the piston. So work is equal to the gas's pressure times the piston's area times the distance it moves. And one more step. The area of the piston times the distance it moves will be equal to the change in the volume of the container. So the work done during an isobaric process is equal to the pressure of the gas times the change in the volume. If heat is added, the volume goes up and the piston moves outward, so the system does work. If you push the piston inward, you're doing work on the system, so its volume goes down. The third type of thermodynamic processes are isothermal. That's where temperature is held constant, usually by connecting the system to a much bigger system, whose temperature would take a lot of heat to change. Known as a heat heat reservoir. The heat or volume of a system is then changed very slowly so that the other properties can adjust while the temperature essentially stays constant. An isothermal process is kind of like an isobaric process in that if you add heat, the volume will expand, so the system will do work. But for isothermal processes, you can't use that simple W equals P delta V equation because the pressure does change. Instead, you need to take the integral of the pressure with respect to volume. This way, you're still calculating work, but you're taking the changes in pressure into account too. Another difference between isobaric and isothermal processes is that since temperature is held constant in isothermal processes, the internal energy of the ideal gas can't change. And the first law of thermodynamics says that heat minus work is equal to the change in the internal energy of the system, in this case, zero. So the work done by the system will be equal to the amount of heat added, and vice versa. Finally, there are adiabatic processes where no heat is allowed to flow in or out of the system, but the gas can expand or be compressed. Again, the equation for the first law of thermodynamics helps us out here. Q is zero because the heat of the system isn't changing, but the internal energy of the gas can change, so the system can do work or have work done on it. In fact, the change in the internal energy of the gas will be exactly equal to the negative of the work. But this is all just the first law of thermodynamics. There's also the second law, which says that heat will spontaneously flow from something hotter to something colder, but it won't flow from something colder to something hotter. And that's because of this thing called entropy. Entropy is often described as the inherent disorder of a system. The more disordered the system, the higher its entropy. So a gas, for example, with all its molecules randomly bouncing around, has a higher entropy than a solid with its molecules neatly arranged. And a more general way to state the second law of thermodynamics is that in real life, entropy can only increase overall. That doesn't mean that entropy can never decrease in certain situations, like gases do sometimes turn into liquids or solids, obviously. You've seen water vapor condense and liquid water freeze. But if the entropy in a system decreases, that means the entropy of the environment around the system must increase enough to compensate and then some, so that there's an overall increase in the entropy of the universe. Say you put water in your freezer to make ice, for example. The entropy of the water goes down as it freezes. But meanwhile, your freezer is putting out heat as it works to keep itself cold inside. And the heat from your freezer is increasing the entropy of your kitchen more than the entropy of the ice is decreasing. So overall, there's an increase in the entropy of the
universe. Huh. So it's crazy that people can't figure out the simplicity of what's actually going on. When you're making your ice in your freezer, you're expending energy, you're moving energy around, but that energy transfer is going out the back of your refrigerator, which is making your kitchen hotter, which means you got to run your air conditioner longer because you got to compensate for the refrigerator.
Right.
So why wasn't a system designed to, whenever you put your refrigerator into like almost a closet that is vented to the outside so that you can transfer that heat energy outside instead of in your room, which would then therefore make your air conditioner not have to come on near as much. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
All these systems are fighting each other. That AC unit works good because it's taking that heat energy and pushing it outside, and there's a heat transfer going on. But if I got a refrigerator, or these computers in here for that matter, these computers are actually producing heat, which that has to be able to compensate for to cool it down. So if I vented all these computers outside during the summertime, the computers would stay cooler for one, and that air conditioner wouldn't have to work as hard, saving energy.
Yeah.
So I move all that energy where I want it. But they don't never design homes with that in mind. So your AC unit's just going to keep on fighting with the refrigerator and, you know, whatever your TV set or anything else that's generating waste heat. So what do you think?
That's silly.
Ah! What? So, you're paying the electric man. That's it. They know.
Yeah, part of me thinks, you know, why are we doing this? But then the other part of me knows why we're not doing this, because,
well,
again,
because
someone's...
Because most people don't think along those lines of, you know, that being that big of a deal. But it is, you know, without... that's why I got this AC going on in the background, because without that AC on, these computers will actually warm this entire room.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of a back and forth battle, which if I would have been smart to begin with, I would have put these in their own box and vented the room, the heat from these computers somewhere else. Now, there's a heat transfer going on as the fan is blowing the room temperature air across that. But imagine if I had these vented outside to where there was an inlet side, and I put that inlet side in the shade and just allowed the heat side to go off into the sunlight. So I would get more efficiency out of these computers. They wouldn't have to work near as hard because they'd stay cooler. Or I could transfer that energy to, water and move that water on down, and I could use these computers right here. Just like the redneck hot tub. Did you ever see that video?
I didn't.
Well, that particular video used a coffee pot element to heat an entire tub. Now, it took 4 to 6 hours to get that that up to operating temperature, but once it got to operating temperature, and this is the key, it didn't take nothing to maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
It's because you're just constantly keeping energy going in that water. The molecules are constantly being agitated, and so it will actually get so hot that you can't sit in there and you have to shut it off. I sat in that thing in the dead of winter in my shorts with snow and ice outside. No insulation under the tub, no insulation around the tub, and open to the cold air. And I was able to sit in that in the wintertime. That's efficiency.
Yeah.
And it was only 110 volt coffee pot element, whatever the wattage is on that particular coffee pot element. That's pretty impressive because most of the doggone hot tubs use like a 220 type deal. Mm-hmm. And so you're using more power and a resistive element in order to try to maintain that water temperature. But when you're also throwing in there pumps that are going to pump the the water around, that water, just the agitation of that water will actually cause the temperature to go up as well. So if you wanted to increase the efficiency of whatever pump, you could pull some of that heat energy off the pump itself. You could just circulate the water and be able to bring the temperature up. As long as you got those molecules in there bouncing around, and you could bring the temperature up. So let's listen to the rest of this one here.
Universe. Remember that every time you're making ice, you're increasing the disorder of the universe. Now, entropy's tendency to increase has to do with probability. To see what I mean, picture a shattered ceramic mug. There are molecules that make up that mug, and there are lots and lots of ways that those molecules can be arranged in space, and all of them are equally likely. But only in a few of those arrangements can the molecules make up a whole, solid, unshattered cup, the state where they have a lower entropy. Still, there are lots of possible arrangements of those molecules where they could make up a shattered cup, a set of pieces with a higher entropy. The cup can be shattered into pieces, 300 pieces, with the pieces far apart or very close together. And every way the cup can shatter is another possible way for the molecules inside the pieces to be arranged. But when there are so many ways for the cup to be broken and so few ways for it to be whole, it becomes very, very unlikely that the pieces will spontaneously put themselves back together if you drop them. Basically, it'll never happen. On the other hand, it's very likely that a cup that's whole will break when you drop it. So the process that leads to an increase in entropy has a much higher probability of happening. And in thermodynamics, entropy is related to heat flow because when heat flows between systems, their entropy increases. Before, when their molecules were different temperatures, that was an orderly arrangement. But when their temperatures become equal, that neat organization is gone, so the systems have a higher entropy. So, heat spontaneously flows from warmer systems to cooler ones because that leads to an increase in entropy, which is also why this little bird keeps bopping up and down. When the heat flows out of it, the gas condenses and it dunks into the water. The bird may not be a perpetual motion machine, but it's a great way to see the first and second laws of thermodynamics in action. Today you learned about the first law of thermodynamics and how it applies to isovolumetric, isobaric, isothermal, and adiabatic processes. We also talked about the second law of thermodynamics and entropy. Crash Course Physics is produced in association with PBS Digital Studios. You can head over to their channel and check out a playlist of the latest episodes from shows like The Good Stuff, Braincraft, and Physics Girl. This episode of Crash Course was filmed in the Dr. Cheryl C. Kinney Crash Course Studio with the help of these amazing people, and our equally amazing graphics team is Thought Cafe.
Cool. So the simple of all of what they just said, heat expands and cold contracts, and hot goes to cold. So all that high-tech terminology out there made it more difficult for the average Joe to understand. But now, after you've heard some of this, does it make a little bit more sense to you?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you throw that high-tech terminology out there, and people's eyes will roll back in their head like, what? Entropy?
it's intimidating when you don't know anything about it.
Yeah, but if you watch nature, you can understand things that nature's doing. Like, have you ever been around a waterfall? How when you're standing under that waterfall, it's like you don't have to be standing in the waterfall, but in the general vicinity, how cool it is in that area. It's because all that evaporative cooling is, doing a heat exchange with the atmosphere outside, whatever temperature it is, and it's just like AC. It's just like air conditioning. So if you lived anywhere near where you had access to a waterfall, you could monopolize on that waterfall by putting a pipe behind the doggone thing and sucking that cold air into your house.
Yeah.
And if you understood how heat rises and cold air falls, then you'd be smart enough to put your AC in the ceiling and your heater in the floor. And that's why I just blows my doors off when I see a lot of buildings, how they're put together. A lot of office spaces have the doggone AC and the heater in the ceiling. And then they wonder why their electric bill is so high.
Right. You're making it do more work.
Yeah, it's crazy. But let's keep moving on here.
Dude, why is it so hot in here? 'Cause I'm in the room.
I can relate.
Okay, that may be a theoretical reason for the room being so hot, but there's a scientific explanation of heat that you need to know. And if you haven't learned it yet, then you're in the right place. Welcome to a video about heat, temperature, and thermal energy. So what is heat? Some might look at a glass of hot water and say, this glass of water contains heat, doesn't it? Actually, objects can't contain heat. However, they can contain thermal energy. In order to understand heat, we have to go through temperature and thermal energy first. So what is temperature? Temperature is the measure of how hot or cold something is compared to a reference point. A reference point is a set temperature that you can refer to, like the freezing point or boiling point of water. The temperature of the object relates to how much kinetic energy is in that object. Kinetic energy is the movement of particles in an object. Let's take this phone for example. When the phone becomes hot, the particles in the phone move faster, generating more energy. When the phone is cooling down, the particles move slower, generating less kinetic energy. There are three scales that are used to measure temperature: the Fahrenheit scale, the Celsius scale, and the Kelvin scale. 0K, or 0 Kelvins, is absolute zero. It's the lowest temperature possible. At absolute zero, particles don't have any kinetic energy. In Celsius, it's negative 273 degrees. In Fahrenheit, it's negative 459 degrees. Fahrenheit is used by the United States, while Celsius is used by most other countries, and Kelvins is used by scientists. Now let's get to thermal energy. Thermal energy is the total energy of all the particles in an object. Thermal energy depends on the temperature of an object and the number of particles in that object. The more particles an object has at a specific temperature, the more thermal energy it has. For example, which one is more thermal energy? A 1-liter cup of milk at 70 degrees or a 2-liter cup of milk at 70 degrees? The answer is the 2-liter cup of milk, because there is more milk in 2 liters compared to 1 liter, which means there's more particles in the 2-liter cup of milk. So therefore, it has more thermal energy. So let's pop the big question. What is heat? Heat is the transfer of thermal energy from a warmer object to a cooler object. The warmer object will cool down and the cooler object will warm up until both objects are the same temperature. When both objects reach the same temperature, heat stops transferring. Heat is measured in units of energy called joules. Heat can be transferred in three ways: convection, conduction, and radiation. Let's start with convection. Convection transfers heat only through fluids, which includes liquids and gases. For example, it could be water and air. Let's take air as our example. When air is heated, it becomes less dense, so it flows to the top. When there's cool air, it becomes more dense, so it sits at the bottom. Let's call the warm air John and the cool air Steve. Now what happens is that John starts to cool down and sinks to the bottom, while Steve starts to warm up and rise to the top. This cycle repeats over and over again, causing a convection current. Convection currents cause wind and different weather patterns. Now let's move on to conduction. Conduction transfers heat between two objects, so from one particle of matter to another. For example, when you heat up soup, the particles from the pot touch the particles of the soup. Since the pot is hot, the particles move faster. When it touches the soup's particles start to move faster, generating heat and making the soup hot. Last but not least, radiation. Radiation is the transfer of energy by electromagnetic waves. It also doesn't require any matter, meaning that you can feel the radiation from an object without actually touching the object. This is how we can feel heat from the sun without physically touching the sun. If a material conducts heat well, it is called a conductor. Some examples of conductors are metals and silver. This is why you might use a metal bowl to heat up something, because metal can transfer heat easily. Also, for the same reason, if you try to sit down on a metal bench outside in the summer sun, it will be really hot, because the metal has trapped in all the heat. Insulators are the opposite of conductors. They do not conduct heat well. For example, wool is used to keep warm because it is an insulator and does not transfer heat out of your body as fast as a conductor would. Another example of an insulator is plastic. If my soup is really hot, I dish the metal spoon and eat it with a plastic spoon so that I don't burn my tongue. Well, now you know everything about heat, temperature, and thermal energy. Stay lit every single day by making sure you like, comment, and subscribe. And besides, what's not to like about Likeable Science?
Yay, so now you know everything there is to know about heat in a simple form. So is that, what do you think? Is that helpful?
Yeah, that's pretty much the limit of what we got to in high school.
Yeah, but
it taught us the absolute basics, but then they were like, that's all you need. Yeah, don't worry about the rest of it.
Well, how many of those folks that learned the basics actually thought past that? Like, what can I do with this? You see what I'm saying? Like, you know, hot air rises and cold air falls, and I say, put your AC in the ceiling and your cold air or your hot air in the floor, and that's going to raise your efficiency. So that AC unit, which is only halfway up the wall, would be more efficient if I had it up towards the ceiling. It'd be so cold you'd have snot sickles in there. You know? And, you know, instead of actually taking the time to cut a hole in the wall up there high above and putting the AC up there, for convenience, I guess it's right down there, but it takes a lot more energy to cool this room down with the location that it is, because you got that hot air pocket which is floating on top of the cold air pocket. Mm-hmm. So if you stood up in this chair, it's warmer up there towards the ceiling. And since you got hot air outside beating down on, sunlight beating down on the ceiling, you can really seriously tell a temperature difference. And since that hot air is transferring to the cold, it's making that have to work yet even harder. So, if you used all these physics, the simple of them, and you circulated cold water on top of your roof up there, it would transfer that heat away from the roof and your attic, and then run it down into your hot water heater while your AC unit at the top was being able to cool down the rest of the lower levels and be incredibly efficient. So just by using the physics of what you learned about heat alone, you could save a lot of money and stick it to the man. And isn't that what the whole deal is about, sticking it to the man?
Well, yeah.
I mean, they've been sticking it to us forever and a day because of high electricity bills. You go to the gas station to get your portion of what they like to classify as fossil fuel. And because it's fossil fuel, that means it's rare, it's scarcity, you know, there's a only limited amount, even though they never seem to run out of it.
Yeah, I was thinking about that earlier. I mean it almost seems like a scare tactic, you know, like, oh, we're gonna run out of this eventually, but, you know, like you're saying, if this can be, you know, all this wasted energy can be redirected and just, you know, we're not going to run out of it.
Yeah, well...
we're going to be using the, you know...
The thing about it is, we're come from a carbon-based world, so everything, plants, leaves, you know, even us, have carbon in them. And all the chemistry necessary to make what they like to call fossil fuel is something as simple as the grass clippings in your yard. As long as nature keeps doing what nature does, heat, temperature, and pressure, the chemistry's been the same since day one as it is now. The Earth is a self-contained biosphere of epic proportions, so you can never, ever, ever run out of anything. It's even when you burn firewood, you think that that firewood's gone. You didn't do nothing to that firewood but change its molecular and chemical structure. Mm. That's all you did. You put heat to it, you burned it, and it separated all the different molecules into other... It created other materials, the same materials that, like nitrogen, you take the ash out of the bottom of the fireplace and you can stick it out there in the garden and use it for putting nitrogen into your soil. Or turn around and use that same ash to make lye soap because of the chemistry that's in it. When you burn that firewood, because of the temperature difference in the stovepipe and the temperature difference outside, it actually builds up moisture inside the pipe that then in turn traps some of that soot and builds up what they call creosote, which is a layer of carbon soot, basically another type of fuel that you're producing. You're burning the firewood, producing different chemistry and another type of fuel up inside there, and you can actually take the exhaust from that doggone thing and re-burn those gases that are coming off of there.
Yeah.
So you can loop that around. There's a wood burning stove that is two barrels. It has one barrel there and it has one barrel up on the top of that, and so when you burn it down here, the gases go up in there because of the temperature inside that second barrel. It reignites and burns a second time and makes it more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as anything could ever be wasted on this world, you can change the chemistry, you can change the molecular structure of it, but you can't destroy any of it. You don't get rid of it. Even when you grow a large crop of food and half of it goes to waste, it all gets recycled back into the system. The system is brilliant in its design. It's amazing. Nature wastes absolutely nothing, so why are we? That's the whole key. So after hearing science like that, does that give you hope that if people would actually take this kind of stuff to heart and start moving towards a better future for everybody, that it's possible?
Well, yeah. I mean, if people took it seriously, I mean, like you said, just watching nature do its thing, you know, why aren't we doing that?
Yeah.
We see that it works. We know that it's, you know, it's happening and it's going to continue happening. It's been happening since the dawn of time.
Nature turns water into gas via evaporation and puts it over there in some other place that needs water. It rains down,
right,
and causes a cooling effect. And so it's a constant recycling of everything. It doesn't matter what you're talking about. Nature recycles everything, including us. So it's a brilliant system. So with that said, let's go to this one right here. This is cool, because if it's one I think about, this guy actually says the word free energy, even though science likes to tell you that there ain't no such thing as free energy.
If you could steal heat from the sun-rich summer and give it to the sun-poor winter, you could be the Robin Hood of the world's energy needs. Hey there, Sunbeams. Trace here for DNews. Solar recently grabbed headlines when the Department of Energy found solar power generation employs more people than generating electricity from oil, coal, and gas combined. In part, it's because of construction, but also because solar workers do way more than just building solar panels. They also work on thermal energy projects. The sun provides enough energy in about 1 hour to power the entire planet for a whole year, and a lot of that is from heat. We're actually pretty bad at leveraging this free energy the universe gives us, but scientists are working to capture
more
of it. For example, researchers from Switzerland...
All right, We gotta hear it again.
A lot of that is from heat. We're actually pretty bad at leveraging this free energy the universe gives us, but scientists are working to capture more of it. For example, researchers from Switzerland developed a new way to capture summer heat and store it all the way until wintertime by taking advantage of the chemical properties of sodium hydroxide, or NaOH. NaOH is a white crystalline odorless solid, and it reacts with water. When you pour water on a mixture containing concentrated NaOH, it releases heat in what's called an exothermic reaction. To control the exothermic reaction, the researchers expose the NaOH to steam, allowing it to release small amounts of heat at a time, just enough to heat up a metal pipe. A solar collector can help reverse this reaction by evaporating the water, leaving NaOH behind. If water is added to the mixture again, the heat will again be released, and this back and forth can be reversed again and again and again. Right now, the NaOH system is still a prototype, so we haven't solved the world's energy needs just yet. But the researchers are looking for industrial partners to help commercialize their technology, which they think could be used to heat homes in the winter, all thanks to chemistry, water, and the sun. As you know, solar energy isn't constant. In the summer, we get more heat than we need, so we use energy to cool down. Come wintertime, we don't have enough heat, so we use energy to warm up again. The most challenging and most important part of solar energy isn't just how to create it or harvest it. It's how do you store it. Not just because of a cloudy day, but...
Pause that for a second. All right, look here. This is crazy. There's this invention called plumbing. It's really amazing. In the movie History of the World Part 1, they're talking about you can pipe the crud right out of your house. Plumbing, pipe the crud right out of your house. That's pretty impressive. But if you got energy in abundance as far as heat in the desert, and somebody over there needs to be hot, you can guide that heat energy from the desert all the way down there using plumbing. And so... logically, if you really cared about supposedly saving the planet because of, you know, carbon emissions, which we all know is a hockahooey, it's probably the biggest hockahooey in the history of hockahooey, but nonetheless, given the devil's due, you take that heat out of the desert, you move it over to somebody who's cold, and you just made it more efficient, and you absolutely use no electricity or what they like to call fossil fuel in order to do it. You just use plumbing and heat transfer. So if the sun is shining on the other side of the world, you can pipe some of that electricity this way, back and forth. So if we built a universal grid system, we could swap energy, Hawaii has all kinds of thermal vents because they're built around volcanic islands. So there's a lot of heat to be had there. You know, and they could make thermoelectric generating plants that would, basically produce electricity, and whatever they couldn't use over there, they could ship down the power line to somebody else. So, my question is to the world, why aren't we doing this? If it's the year 2019, and this stuff they obviously had to have known years ago, they could have moved towards that. But there is a reason why they don't. Is your wallet. They want it. And everything in it. They want you to have a credit card, a bank account, and everything. Because as long as you got that, you got to go to work and make more money to pay them.
That they can tax and then take more of it.
Yeah. So, how many times you get taxed? I don't know. Everybody should figure that out sometimes. How much taxes you really pay. You go to the store and buy yourself a soda and you got to pay extra taxes on that. You buy a car and you never seem to really own the car because if you don't pay the taxes, they'll shut you down. Or even your property or your house, if you don't pay your taxes, they'll steal it out from under you. So that ought to be a red flag.
Yeah. Seems awfully greedy.
Yeah, but that's money makes the world go around. That's how they're able to keep control of everybody, by basically telling you that things are scarce and you need to pay this, or for your safety. That's the one I hate the most, for your safety. The EPA actually made carbon dioxide basically said it's a toxic waste. Maybe not the exact terminology, but that's equivalent to what they said.
That's plant food, man.
Yeah.
They're making more oxygen for us with that.
Yep, that's the whole thing. You know, they turn CO2 into sugar and makes plant food. And so wherever they, you ever notice how they're always mowing out by the street? Why is that? That's because all the cars keep going down through there. Carbon monoxide, which is actually what comes out of your car, not carbon dioxide. It's one oxygen atom connected to one carbon atom, which makes it more dangerous because it's small enough to fit down in your respiratory system and basically give you lead poisoning, carbon poisoning. And carbon dioxide is a big one. It's two oxygen atoms connected to one carbon atom, and it displaces oxygen, and so you can suffocate with too much CO2. But the plants scrub that carbon off of both the carbon monoxide and the carbon dioxide and make plant food out of it, and they so you got 10-foot tall weeds if you don't right down the street.
Is that where everything right by the road is so much higher than
yeah.
all the grass in the yards and stuff?
That's it. That's why they're mowing so much out there. A lot of the old greenhouses, modern-day greenhouses, will actually flood the greenhouse when all the workers are gone with CO2 to make those plants grow better.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, it's a toxic deal according to the EPA.
Right.
Dangerous.
It's a toxic waste.
So every time you open your mouth, you're breathing out toxic fumes. Now, if you've been hitting the Gentleman Jack, that might be the truth. But if you're just breathing just regular fresh air, then you're just feeding the plants, and they're feeding us. You ever wondered why you're sleepier inside than you are outside?
Not getting as much oxygen to your brain.
Yeah, and there's a lot more higher levels of CO2 in the air, and it pushes away the oxygen, so it makes you a little drowsy being inside. But if you got a lot of house plants, we have a symbiotic relationship with them, and they give us fresh air. That's why on the airplane they have to have artificial scrubbers to scrub off the carbon in order to be able to keep fresh air in the cabin.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy, ain't it? Let's hear some more what this guy got to say. But he did say free energy, so the cat's out of the bag.
A cloudy season. If we repeated this simple chemical reaction all summer, using the sun to add energy, the generated heat could be stored until needed in the winter, weaning ourselves off dirty fossil fuels. But how? Batteries, they suck. We've talked about this a lot. They're actually one of the worst options for solar energy storage. Mostly because current batteries are limited in the number of times you can charge them, they're fairly expensive, and the types of batteries you would need for this application would be huge. With a bit more chemistry and physics, you can store the power of the sun in salt. Most power generation facilities use heat to generate steam and turn a system of turbines. Seriously, that's nuclear, coal, gas, solar, all of them. Wind and hydro, they turn the turbines with something else. The Abengoa Solar Solana plant in the Arizona desert uses over 3,000 parabolic mirrors to heat water and turn their turbines. But they can also focus the sunlight to heat large insulated tanks of salt, causing it to melt. The molten salt stores the energy gathered during the day, which can later be used to turn the turbines at night. Unfortunately, this strategy can only store energy for about 6 hours. To store energy throughout the year, we're going to have to get more creative, like by putting it underground, which is actually what the Swiss researchers suggested for their NaOH system, a geothermal probe. Today, one of the most common strategies for seasonal solar thermal storage is known as borehole heat storage. This essentially uses the heat capacity of soil to store large amounts of heat underground for months. It works by drilling an array of boreholes from about 30 to 200 meters deep. During hot summer months, the heat is transferred to water, which is then stored deep in the soil and rock inside the borehole. That stored heat can later be extracted when needed and used for all sorts of things. Italy, Germany, Sweden, and the Netherlands all use these systems, sometimes seemingly keeping nest eggs of heat under their houses like a neighborhood of giant chickens. The challenge with the borehole strategy, though, is that you need access to drillable land, and for most people, like those who live in urban areas, that's simply not an option. Hopefully someday, with a combination of solar thermal plants...
There's not much left of that podcast anyway, but when we're talking about heat transfer, burying it underground is a good place to store that deal. But if there's a temperature difference under your house, like in your basement, mm-hmm. and the temperature difference in your attic, like it gets really hot in your attic and really cool down there in your basement. So those two right there, you could use that heat energy transfer to get work done, to move stuff around.
Without even having to go underground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what you said about having to dig down under the ground isn't necessarily the case if you understand that physics of how heat and cool, you know, work together. You basically turn your house into an incredibly efficient machine.
And I mean, you know, you said it's, you know, it's not as possible, you know, in urban areas, but you think, I mean, all those super high-rise buildings,
yeah.
same deal, you know, that top floor is going to, without any kind of help running to heat or cool the house, that top floor is going to be way hotter. Yep. The bottom floor.
How many floors are we talking about?
We'll say, you know, even Mark's last apartment was 10 floors. They were on the 9th.
Okay, so you got a 10-story one, and like
yeah.
you said, it's hotter at the top than it is at the bottom.
Yeah.
But imagine this. If you took that, you pumped the water up, allow water to go up via evaporation up a pipe,
mm-hmm.
and then it hit that hot deal up there, you know, and that's how you actually got the water to evaporate to begin with, because it got hot up there. Then when that water run through a condensing system, which would change the temperature, the temperature difference, and cause that water to flash back into, that steam to flash back into water, when that water is falling down, it produces pressure. And so you can have a Venturi pipe sticking out of your downflow pipe, which gravity's pulling the water down, and it would actually produce a vacuum on this side right here. Or you could use the downward pressure to push air out, like compressed air.
Mm.
And that compressed air expanding rapidly would cause a cooling effect. So one side's a vacuum and the other side is a air pressure coming out. So the downward would suck air in this way, and then that air pressure would come back out the other side without the water. The water would continue to go down and push cool air into it. So you'd have gravity-fed air conditioning. This has been done before. They had like a 300-foot cave going down, and they dropped water down this and produced air pressure. As the water's coming down, it would suck air in from the outside, and then it would pressurize this cave. So you got water here, and you got a big old air pocket under here, and then they ran those lines up to their mills and run their machinery off of air pressure. It's like having an air tank with no electricity, just using physics.
Why aren't more people doing this?
I don't know. It's all about the money. Scotty Sovereign in the Shazoo's chat room says because they want to keep the cash flow going. And that's it. And he said it's assumed that out of cash earned, 54 or 56% of your money goes to taxes. So even when you go get your electric bill, there's hidden taxes in it. Your cell phone, hidden taxes.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. That's why I try to talk to the average Joe out there to make them understand what the reality of real science is. This is real science. The other stuff is for show. And when they put physics out there on the table and try to tell you according to the laws of thermodynamics, this ain't possible. It's a hockahooey. It's a lie. And when their whole danger to the world, you know, the world's supposed to end in 12 years according to the global warming alarmists.
I thought it was supposed to end 7 years ago.
Well, back in the day, it was supposed to end, it, not counting the Y2K bug, but it was supposed to end, the sea levels were supposed to rise, and the polar bears were going to drown, even though polar bears can swim for miles. And the same guy that was out there, Al Gore, saying Earth in the Balance, he wrote a book about and made lots of money, millions of dollars, writing his book, basically fear-mongering that the water was all going to rise and sea levels and everything. He buys a 9-bedroom mansion, guess where? right on the seashore. Now, this guy who says the world's going to be doomed is going to move his house right next to the seashore, then maybe he don't really believe what he was saying. Maybe he's just playing everyone else for a sucker, because who's going to check it out? 20 years from now, you go back and look at the data, the sea level was this high, and you come back and now, and you look, and now the sea level might be a fraction or two, a little deeper, possibly because some of that land got eroded away from the the doggone waves coming in and out, and so it's deeper here than it was 20 years ago, when if you go over here, it's shallower, because when you dug that sand out, the water went in and filled it up, and now this has got more sand, so it's not as deep over there. That's the simple of it, but you can't tell the average Joe that.
So Y2K was lazy programmers?
Yeah. Yeah, Troy cracks me up. Yeah, that's that whole Y2K, I got the Y2K bug. You see him up there? You drop him and it crashes. You hear a crashing sound like glass breaking. But it was funny, you know. They thought the whole world was coming to an end during the Y2K, but common sense dictated that by the time, you know, that got around, they already had patches for, you know, any possibility. And if any computer ever acted up, it was older systems that hadn't been updated or whatever. So, as far as I know, very few computers even reacted to that changeover. So, it was a hockahooey. They were supposed to crash, because the computer wouldn't know where to go from 999. But, hey, they say there's no cure for stupid. So, let's finish this out. I'm sure he's got something really intelligent to say. Not much left of this one.
Geothermal and borehole facilities, as well as concentrated sodium hydroxide, we might get close to weaning ourselves off fossil fuels forever.
See?
If solar energy is so great, fossil why aren't fuels. We using more of it? You can find out by watching this video. And let us know down in the comments what your favorite type of energy generation is. I really like nuclear. I know that's controversial. Let us know in the comments. Make sure you subscribe. And thanks for watching DNews.
And see, that's another thing, too, about the nuclear. There's a big debate out there about whether or not nuclear is as dangerous as people think. And, you know, I don't think that nuclear is dangerous at all. But nonetheless, even the devil's due. If you say you got a problem and you're not listening to any of the doggone solutions, then something's wrong. So, you know, we got thorium reactors that we could build. We've got plasma reactors that we could build. We've got heat pump systems. We got all the science, all the physics necessary to resolve every single part of the so-called energy crisis in the world, including the whole fossil fuel. You know why most folks are out there fighting in war right now?
Fuel?
Yeah.
Oil.
They want somebody else's oil. And not necessarily that they want their oil, because they know they got their own, but the fact that if these folks over there get to sell their oil, they might sell it for a cheaper price than what we can sell it for and run us out of business.
And we're back to the money issue.
Yeah. Once again.
Gotta keep making money.
And the gas pump, it goes up whenever they say the demand is higher. And so if you ever want to see cheaper gas prices, tell all your friends, don't go to the gas pump for a week. Just put a little bit of gas in your car and try not to go anywhere. And then watch, a week later, you go to your gas station and the prices will be way down. Because they end up with a surplus.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen a lot of things, you know, floating on the internet about, you know, having a strike of sorts, you know, from getting gas. If everybody in the country just for one day did not buy gasoline, go to a gas station and fill up their cars,
it'd be dirt cheap.
They would panic.
Yeah, it'd be
like,
dirt
well,
cheap.
Well, what do we do now?
They'd have all these tankers that are needed to go fill the gas station up, and these tankers would have to sit there idle. It'd cost them money because the driver would be sitting there with it watching his watch. Oh, man, are they out of gas over there yet? What? And then that's the ships coming in with the oil to the refineries. They wouldn't have no place to put it, so the ships would be setting offshore. Back during the old Arab embargo deal, there were tankers setting offshore that couldn't come in because there wasn't no place to put the fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And they were supposedly not get being able to get the oil. But that's that's the dirty little secret of the system. They're going to tell you that there ain't none so that they can sell it to you for a higher price. Mm-hmm. We can make diamonds using physics. The problem is, our diamonds are perfect. Nature's are not perfect.
Right.
So there's little tiny flaws in a diamond, which will determine the type of value on this. You know, the clarity and the color and all that. It's like, you know, we can mimic it. We can literally take carbon and we can use pressure and heat just like nature does, and we can form a diamond. They call them cubic zirconians, and they are diamonds, but they're not natural diamonds.
Right.
So they're worth less, according to the. But it's the same material.
Right.
Same exact material.
You know, because somebody's just sitting, you know, somebody's sitting in a lab somewhere making it rather than someone going and digging it out.
Yeah.
And using all that manpower to.
We can make our own pearls.
Yeah.
All you got to do is know what nature does. How does nature make a pearl? You know, a doggone clam sitting down there getting plankton as it's opening and closing his deal. A fish swims by and flicks a little piece of sand down his throat, and he's like, can't spit it out because clams don't have a tongue. You know, so he can't go phooey like that to get rid of the sand. And so the clam's immune system says there's a foreign body in there and decides I got to get rid of it, but I can't spit it out, so it coats it up, and mm-hmm. you end up with a pearl. And so we know how to make cultured pearls.
Mm-hmm.
We can do this intentionally. But cultured pearls, even though they're made out of the same exact stuff, are not natural. So they're not worth as much.
Yeah.
But who determines the price? The man. The same man selling you the gasoline and the electricity. He's a scam artist.
I don't know who this guy is, but I don't like him.
Well, I think he's related to Uncle Sam. You know, Uncle Sam, he's got a big old mansion with a gold tooth and bling hanging around his neck and driving one of those cars with the hydraulics that goes zzz, 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 and he drives down the road going doom, doom, doom. And he jumps out with his gold tooth and say, hey, I need some tax money. Right? That's how that's working. I'm serious. You ever see Uncle Sam, you'll know what I'm talking about. You'll be able to pick him out in the crowd. He's got it all. Man, got the best seat in the house. Tell you what. Oh, wow. But, you know, hey, giving Uncle Sam his dues, man. He keeps us all, you know, safe and, you know, helps us out. Never sends us... Wait a second. He does send us to war because I seen a poster that said, Uncle Sam wants you.
Right.
I want you.
And your tax money.
And your tax money. I need you to give me tax money, and I need you to put on this uniform and go over there and fight those people so they don't sell their oil cheaper than us.
I need your money so that I can pay to send you to another place to fight somebody else.
Yeah, you're going
to
pay for your
money.
Own ticket
yeah.
via your taxes.
Oh, man.
And your mama and your brother and his cousin and his friend down the street are going to pitch in and fly you over there so that you can fight with these people.
All expenses paid.
Yeah, all expenses. It ain't coming out of Uncle Sam's wallet. It's coming out of yours. That's the dirty little secret. And they say there ain't no such thing as free energy. Uncle Sam knows doggone good and well there's free energy. He's got a free, never-ending wallet, a credit card, unlimited resources called the American people. And to some extent, every other nation out there that wants to ship any goods into our country. Because they get charged taxes and tariffs to bring stuff in.
Man, I'd like to have that special credit card just for a day.
Yeah.
You know, my kid's going through diapers pretty fast. They're getting expensive.
You could buy a whole freaking skyscraper full of diapers. The kid would be out of college before you used them all. And you could donate them to somebody else. Just off of one day's of Uncle Sam's credit card. That's crazy. All right, so let's move right along here.
Whether you're heating up leftovers from last night or just trying to stay cool in the summer, heat transfer is everywhere. In some ways, the world is literally built around it. Any well-engineered building is designed and made out of materials that help keep the inside of the building at a good temperature, even during bitter blizzards or horrendous heat waves. A furnace or AC will only get you so far. Without protecting against heat transfer, you might as well try to air condition your whole neighborhood. A big part of engineering is using your knowledge of natural processes to keep them from interfering with whatever you're trying to do, or in some cases, taking advantage of those processes. So without a solid understanding of how and why heat moves the way it does, your designs won't be very successful, especially if you've just discovered a tropical island. So, this tropical island, it's small, totally deserted, and seems like the perfect place to build that vacation home you've always dreamed of. The tropical weather is really nice, but it's also hot. Very hot. So you'll probably want to design your house to keep the heat out and the cold in. In other words, you'll want to prevent as much heat transfer as possible. Even though heat isn't a fluid itself, heat transfers in a way that's kind of similar to the fluid movement we've talked about in past episodes. When fluids move, there's always a driving force behind them, specifically a difference in either pressure or velocity. With heat transfer, the driving force is a difference in temperature. In fact, if you don't have a temperature difference, you can't have heat transfer. Period. If you have two boxes right next to each other and they're both at the same temperature, then one of the boxes won't randomly start giving its heat energy away to the other one. But if you're watching this video on your laptop and it's, well, on top of your lap, then your legs might be warming up as the heat is transferred to them from your laptop. That's because right now your laptop is warmer than your skin. And when heat passively transfers, it always moves from a higher temperature to a lower one. You'd have to use the cycles and work energy we talked about before, basically an engine, to make it move in the opposite direction. And unless you have perfect insulation, which is practically impossible in most settings, then a temperature difference will cause heat transfer. So this house you're building is going to heat up from the warm tropical air no matter what. But there's a lot you can do to slow down the process. There are three main types of heat transfer to look out for: conduction, convection, and radiation. With conduction, heat energy is transferred by the collisions of molecules or other particles. When two things touch, the faster moving molecules of the warmer object crash into the slower moving molecules of the colder object, transferring energy that heats them up. In your house, that will cause heat transfer through the layers of the walls. As the outer layer warms up, conduction will transfer the heat through to the cooler inner layers. To slow this down, you'll want to build the walls out of a material with low thermal conductivity. Something that doesn't transfer heat well. Copper, for example, has a high thermal conductivity. So if you made your walls out of it, you'd effectively be making a giant sauna, which doesn't sound like a great place to live. For one thing, it would probably be a burn hazard. Materials like brick and drywall, on the other hand, have lower thermal conductivities, so they'd be much better choices. Anything that's sold as insulation also has a very low thermal conductivity, so you'll probably want some layers of that too. The thicker these layers, the more resistant the walls will be to heat transfer by conduction. Specifically, they'll have more of what's called thermal resistance, which is defined as the thickness of the layer of the material divided by the material's thermal conductivity and the area of the layer. All this means is that materials with a lower thermal conductivity have a higher thermal resistance, and that a thicker layer will also have a higher thermal resistance. But if there's more area for heat to be conducted through, that will lower the thermal resistance. Thermal resistance is also equal to the temperature difference divided by the heat transfer rate, which also makes sense. It means that for a given temperature difference, materials with a higher heat transfer rate will have a lower thermal resistance, and vice versa. You can use this equation to determine the level of thermal resistance you'll need if you want a low rate of heat transfer for the temperature difference you'd expect to have in the layers of your walls. And the resistance of the different layers adds up, so the total thermal resistance of the walls is equal to the resistance of each layer combined. It's like putting on layers of clothing on a cold day. The more layers you have, the lower your rate of heat loss will be, and the easier it is to stay warm. So for your house, if the drywall and brick don't have enough thermal resistance to keep the inside cool, you can add layers of insulation to up the resistance. That takes care of the heat transfer within the walls, but there's more going on outside of them, which brings us to the second method of heat transfer, convection. the transfer of energy by the physical movement of a fluid, which in engineering can be a liquid or a gas. Mm-hmm. As a fluid moves against or across the surface, it can...
So, have you heard one common denominator about everything, about all this energy transfer going on?
And mostly the loss of heat, the use of the heat.
There's heat everywhere.
Yeah.
And so if you want to be cool inside, you got to figure out a way to keep the outside outside and the inside inside. Vice versa and the other deal. So that's where the insulation comes into play. But even the best insulated houses have a big old attic space that... it gets hotter than heck up there. Why aren't they monopolizing on that temperature inside that attic and pumping that heat down into the basement and then allowing it to rise back up again? You could suck the hot air out of your attic, run it down into the basement, and then allow that heat to rise again. So just by circulating the heat that's already up there and maximize the efficiency of your doggone insulation that's in your ceiling. What do you think?
I still want to know why more people aren't talking about this.
It's mind-blowing. That's why mad science exists, because people just... I don't know what it is. I think we all went to the same schools, but maybe some of them just didn't pay attention in science, because, it could get boring, especially when you're hearing all the high-tech terminology and mathematical equations. But if you just drop it down to the simplicity of everything, heat rises, cold air falls. It's that ridiculously simple. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that. The deeper you get in water, the colder the water gets. The warmer it is at the top. And so at the surface of the pool, it's kind of warmer than it is at the bottom of the pool. So, put your finger down right here. Hey, that's not bad. And jump in, and then... You find out it is kind of bad.
That's why I always like these crash course videos. We watched a lot of these in school, and just the simple fact of they make a little cartoon and make it so easy to understand.
Yeah.
And they're not throwing all the big words at you that no one understands.
That's the whole deal. A lot of the folks out there, if you had more people teaching like that with visuals, like you just explained, you'd have a lot smarter kids, because they wouldn't be getting bored by, seeing this. They're seeing how this actually works and seeing, it's like some people are really good hands-on. Some people are good just watching and listening to videos, and they learn really good that way. But if you sit around all day long trying to get somebody to memorize this and memorize that, Fahrenheit, Kelvin, Celsius, what? Alright, well, a simple thing would be, heat rises and cold air falls. There's a temperature difference there. And that kind of cold, that hot goes to the cold. You just explained it all without all the math and craziness.
Right.
That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to help people like that. That's it.
Add or take away heat. For example, as air heats up, its particles spread out, lowering its density. That warmer air rises, taking heat energy with it, and is replaced by cooler, denser air. That's called natural convection, because variations in the temperature of the fluid create natural movement without any external forces. There's also forced convection, where something external, like a fan or the wind, moves the fluid. Heat transfer by convection actually involves some conduction, especially at first. When the warm outside air comes into contact with your house's walls, it creates the no-slip condition we've talked about before, where the layer touching the surface comes to a stop. Right on top of that, there's what's called a boundary layer, where the air is moving, but slowly. The lower velocity slows down the rate of heat transfer, creating a thermal boundary layer where there's more conduction between the particles and less convection. Beyond the boundary layer, though, heat transfer mostly happens by convection, through the faster moving air. You can measure how much heat is being transferred by convection using what's known as the convective heat transfer coefficient, represented by the letter H. It's proportional to the thermal conductivity of the fluid over the thickness of the boundary layer, which just means that thinner fluids with higher thermal conductivity will transfer more heat. Makes sense. Age also depends on how fast a fluid is moving. The less the gas moves around, the less heat is transferred through convection. That's why windows often have double panes. The air trapped between the layers of glass can't move very much, reducing the heat transfer. So double pane windows are probably a good idea for your house. There's not much else you can do to minimize the effects of convection, since you can't really control what the air does as it moves around outside. But you can reduce the effects of the last type of heat transfer, radiation. Radiation is the transfer of energy in the form of electromagnetic waves. And in this context, we're talking about any electromagnetic waves, not just the cancer-causing kind. You feel this radiation every time you walk outside and bask in the sun or warm up by a fire. Unlike conduction and convection, radiation can happen without any contact between the heat source and the object. That's why heat energy from the sun is able to reach the Earth. Reflective coatings can help reduce the heat transfer from radiation a little, since they absorb fewer electromagnetic waves. But when it comes to radiation, where your house is will be much more important than what it's made of. Since the sun will likely be the biggest radiative source, you'll want to build the house somewhere where it won't get too much direct sunlight. So there's a lot of factors to consider when you're trying to minimize heat transfer. But with a shady spot, walls with lots of thermal resistance, and some double-paned windows, you should have a pretty comfortable place to hang out on your tropical island. So today, we learned all about heat transfer and the different mechanisms behind it. We started with conduction and learned about the thermal conductivity of materials. Then we moved on to convection and boundary layers, learning that convection can be both forced and natural. Finally, we covered radiation and how it differs from the other two methods, in that it doesn't need an intervening medium to transfer heat energy. Next time, we'll talk about how we can use what we just learned about heat transfer and apply that to heat exchangers. Crash Course Engineering is produced in association with PBS Digital Studios. You can head over to their channel to check out a playlist of their amazing shows, like It's Okay to Be Smart, Above the Noise, and Global Weirding with Catherine Hayhoe. Crash Course is a Complexly production, and this episode was filmed in the Dr. Shell C. Kinney studio with the help of these wonderful people, and our amazing graphics team is Thought Cafe.
Alrighty then. So, we've learned a lot today about heat. We've learned, what I'm trying to wonder is, how come the system hasn't learned that yet? Why is it that, you know, you got this crazy haired guy in his little mad science lab can figure it all out, but these people with multi-billion dollar machine shops and tools and unlimited resources from the taxpayers, of course, can't figure it out? It don't make no sense. I mean, after you heard all this, does it sound as difficult? Does it sound like rocket science to you?
No. No, I mean, I think that's the problem. I think they have figured it out. I think they're just...
They want to keep the cash flow going.
Yeah. Anyone that has figured it out that's not in the circle, they're saying, hey, 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 you can be quiet.
Yeah.
Keep it to yourself.
There's stories out there about people who had developed carburetting systems that would get several hundred miles to the gallon. And then suddenly, they up and disappear. But if you look into the so-called conspiracy of the thing, well, the physics makes sense. By how you deliver that fuel to the engine will determine of how efficient it is. For example, when you got a fuel injected system, you're putting too much fuel into that deal. Otherwise, you wouldn't need a catalytic converter. A catalytic converter is only a reburner of whatever waste fuel. Some of that gas from getting reburnt in the catalytic converter actually makes it back up to the intake side again. But nonetheless, if you vaporize that fuel before you send it in instead of sending it into as a stream, then that is going to ignite a lot cleaner because you're not cramming so much in there. When you cram that much fuel in there, you have to compensate with pulling more oxygen in. So you have a O2 sensor that will determine how much oxygen is being running through this system, And when the O2 sensor detects a low oxygen, which means your fuel ain't burning efficient, then it opens up the throttle body there that lets more air into the intake and cuts back on the fuel. So, if it was done properly to begin with, by all rights, you should use less fuel the harder you mash down on that gas, because when that piston, when you're just sitting there idling, it's going up and down like that, but whenever you start racing, it's going up and down like that. Well, that faster speed of that piston goes up there means the less time that fuel has a chance to burn. Mm-hmm. And so you should be cutting back on the fuel instead of trying to put so much in there, cutting back and vaporizing it so that you use less fuel the faster you go. But in order to get these cars to do what they do, they cram more fuel and more oxygen in there. And that's why you got basically a blow-by of fuel going out the exhaust. And then down, it doesn't have a chance to burn. So we go through a catalytic converter, which uses a catalyst inside there that the oxygen reacts with and causes it to get real hot. The oxygen and the hydrogen inside that fuel gets real hot with this catalyst, and it reburns that, and some of the gases make it in there, and whatever burns off actually goes out the back, and that's your emissions. It's crazy. But you can re-engineer those engines to be so incredibly efficient. If your average engine's running at anywhere from 160 to 220 degrees Fahrenheit, that's a lot of heat. Imagine what you could do with that heat. The only place that you need heat in that engine and outside of inside the cab of the car or the vehicle you're in is in the cylinder. That's the only place you need heat. So why is the whole doggone engine blistering hot? You could build that engine out of insulating material that would not allow that heat to escape except for out the exhaust, and that would mean that it would get so incredibly hot inside that you'd actually have to cut back on the fuel and get a cleaner burn every time it comes in there. Just like old diesel technology was able to use the glow plug to start it, heat it up, and then take the glow plug completely out of the deal. And now you had compression ignition from the heat, the pressure, bam. You drive a diesel. Diesel trucks are pulling around 40 to, whatever feet, trailers full of tons of stuff going to the store for you to buy and pay taxes on.
And pay taxes on. So isn't they can crazy? Send my neighbor to war.
Yep. So you can send your neighbor out to war to keep the cycle going. That's the whole deal. Money, that's it. If it wasn't for that, if people started listening to mad science and actually enacting the solutions that have been coming out here for years, they would start building a society where everything was incredibly efficient. You would have a zero waste project where none of the trash that you threw in the trash is actually trash. It's a resource. But you combine all this trash and it becomes then garbage that gets hauled off to the dump and it has to fill up the landfill. But utilized properly, you could recycle every single bit of what you throw in your garbage. Everything. There's nothing that you throw in your garbage that could not be recycled. You can turn old food waste into methane, store that methane in tanks, and use it for winter time to heat your house with. And take the exhaust fumes from that, run them into your greenhouse to feed your plants.
Mm-hmm.
So, why aren't we doing that? Why don't we have built-in recycling systems that are running into, plasma gasification systems that takes plastic and turns it into fuel, takes paper, turns it into fuel, takes everything that is carbon-based and turns it into fuel, and whatever it can't burn, it turns it into a usable material that you can pave your roads with. We've talked about all these things on Mad Science. And, you know, now they're talking about storing heat energy. So let's go to this one right here.
You may have relaxed in a natural hot springs pool, or seen the old faithful geyser blasting hot water into the air in Yellowstone National Park. But have you ever thought of where all that heat comes from? Well, it comes from deep beneath the surface of the Earth, and it's called geothermal energy. And we can use it to generate clean, renewable electricity. Okay, here's how geothermal works. Heat from the Earth's crust warms water that has seeped into underground reservoirs. In some places, when water becomes hot enough, it can break through the Earth's surface as steam or hot water. This usually happens where the Earth's crust or plates meet and shift. In the past, taking advantage of geothermal energy was limited to areas where hot water flowed near the surface. But as geothermal technologies advance, we can leverage even more of these natural, renewable energy sources. Engineers have developed a few different ways to produce power from geothermal wells drilled into the ground. Have a look at this. It's a dry steam geothermal power plant, and it's the most common type of geothermal technology used today. Underground steam flows directly to a turbine to drive a generator that produces electricity. Pretty straightforward. Another geothermal technology is called a flash steam power plant. A pump pushes hot fluid into a tank at the surface, where it cools. As it cools, the fluid flashes, or quickly turns into vapor. The vapor then drives a turbine and powers a generator. A binary cycle plant works differently.
What he didn't say, which is really important, when he said that when that material flashes and vaporizes, is that it builds up pressure. Mm-hmm. And that pressure is what actually does the work. And the same thing is how electricity actually works. You can build up pressure and store that pressure. So all energy can be stored.
It uses two types of fluid. Hot fluid from underground heats a second fluid, called a heat transfer fluid, in a giant heat exchanger. The second fluid has a much lower boiling point than the first fluid, and so it flashes into vapor at a lower temperature. When the second fluid flashes, it spins a turbine that drives a generator. The environmental benefits of this clean, round-the-clock, renewable energy source are substantial. Low emissions, small physical footprint, and minimal environmental impact. The few byproducts that can come up are often reinjected underground. Geothermal energy can also help recycle wastewater. In California, wastewater from the city of Santa Rosa is injected into the ground to generate more geothermal energy. Some plants do produce solid waste, but that solid waste may contain minerals that we can remove and sell, which lowers the cost of this energy source. The U.S. Geological Survey estimates that untapped geothermal resources in the United States, if developed, could supply the equivalent of 10% of today's energy needs and cut our dependence on fossil fuels. In fact, electricity generated by geothermal energy already provides about 60% of the power along the Northern California coast, from the Golden Gate Bridge to the Oregon state line. Geothermal energy, helping to push America toward energy independence and a clean, renewable way to meet our growing energy demands.
All right, so that's basically the last podcast there. So, to sum up, what did we learn with all that? That we're like incredibly inefficient.
We're wasting so much. So many things.
Yeah. In the food industry, tons and tons of food get wasted. Why would you do that? Because that food is also a fuel. It's also a fertilizer. There's so many different things that you could actually do with that if it got to the point where it wasn't fit for human consumption. But where does it end up? In a landfill. Why? Because you could turn that back into fuel again. You could turn it back into resources. There's nothing that nature wastes. Absolutely nothing whatsoever that nature wastes. Mankind, on the other hand, fills up a hole full of garbage and then goes out and digs another hole to put the next batch in. Now, there are some people out there that got smart, and they turn their doggone garbage disposal into a resource so that they collect, you know, rare metals and not-so-rare metals and, you know, different types of plastics and all this stuff, and they basically turn their trash into a revenue source. So a landfill that used to be a landfill now is getting money from you to take your garbage out, and then they're taking your garbage and they're using their system to sort it and separate it and make money off. They're selling your trash
while they're making you pay to haul it away, for them to haul it away.
Yeah. So you're paying to haul off the gold and the resources, which you could turn around. Just in the old computers and stuff like that, there's gold and silver in those computers. There's copper. There's all kinds of rare metals that could be salvaged and materials that could be utilized and stuff. Your plastic bottles, your plastic bags, there ain't nothing that's made out of plastic that can't be recycled. You could turn it back into gasoline if you want. You can turn it into diesel fuel. You can turn it into lantern fluid. You could take that doggone plastic and run a generator with it using a plasma gasification system, or even just a standard gasification system for that matter. And what do you do when you do all this? Well, guess what? You produce more heat. And there ain't no such thing as free energy. Just in the process of using energy, we produce heat. And so since heat is supposedly the bad guy, we got to have fans and radiators and stuff to get rid of it.
Which also make more heat.
Yeah, which makes more heat. And we turn around and put this heat into the atmosphere, and then they holler about global warming. You're dumping all the heat out. Go down to the city where all the paved roads and concrete are with a thermometer in your hand and check out the temperature. Then come all the way out to the country, stand on the hill and do the same exact thing. That's odd. It's hotter than heck in the city, but it's cool as heck out here. Wonder why that is. Oh no, you got 100,000 cars driving down the road. You got the sun beating off the pavement. Nowhere for the heat to go except into the concrete, which makes it heat up and then radiate out to your face. Not to mention the fact the sun's coming over and everybody wants to block the sun out of their building. So they put these reflective two-way mirror glass on there. And so you're getting a suntan while you're standing there waiting for the bus to come by and choking on the smoke. Imagine that. Common sense. Oh, there ain't no such thing as common sense anymore. It just gone by the wayside. But all of those can be explained, and all of them could be averted. You could actually monopolize on the heat that would have been coming through the window using modern-day technology. They're actually getting transparent solar panels. So while the sunlight is coming through the window, it's actually generating electricity. So you could turn the entire building into a power source. Your house is already a power source. It's cool in the basement. It's hot at the top. What can you do with that? It's got the sun beating on the roof. It's got the wind blowing against the shutters or whatever. Every single motion that house makes, including your kid running in and out all day long, and you keep hollering, "We're not heating outside." You know? Well, in that portion of flapping that door open, you can put little magnets on the door and it going back and forth across coils, charging up your cell phone instead of using the power grid. Even opening the refrigerator. If you got somebody who snacks quite frequently, every time the refrigerator comes on. That's another question. Does that light bulb go off when you shut the refrigerator door?
Yeah.
How do you know?
Because the button.
The door's shut, though.
Right.
What if the button ain't working? Got to open it real quick. Peek in.
Well, you can just open it and press the button.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that would be logical. How many people would think that? Yeah, there was a cartoon a long time ago. This guy's freaking out trying to figure out whether or not the light really goes off when you shut the door. That's electricity. But, you know, if you actually really sit down and contemplate on everything that you've heard here today, there is no such thing as a loss unless you deem it to be a loss. And if you want to become super efficient, then you have to understand the basics of everything. Where does the heat go? Where does the energy go? You know, when you're burning stuff or whatever, the little simple of all of it will show you how to save money. You know, heat rises, cold air falls. I keep saying that because that's probably the one that gets ignored the most when people are building houses. They don't seem to get the fact that you know, if you put both of them in the same exact pipe just to save money, then in the long term, you're going to actually be paying more money. Energy costs. But if you run a dual duct system, that sounds pretty cool, dual duct. You can say that 10 times without laughing. If you put a dual ducting system inside there to where in the, you know, summertime, it'll flip the little flap going one direction and pump the heat out of the attic and out the other direction, causing a draft that pulls cool air up out of your basement, then you save you a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
It stays cool down in the basement. So, let me see here. What else did we not talk about? I think we done hit it all, man. What do you think? Have you learned anything today?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
3 hours got me more than 4 years of high school ever got me.
Well, and that's why I think that, you know, more people, you know, need to hear these podcasts. So, folks, if you're out there listening in and, you know, you like what you heard there, take a copy of this podcast and play it to the kids. You know, let them learn a little bit something. Because they're the ones that in the future that really would benefit, because they'd start thinking about how I want to build my house. If I want to build a house, I want to make this house be as efficient as possible so I got more money in my pocket. Ain't going to make the man happy.
It's a lot of reason why I want to homeschool my kid.
Yep.
To make sure they've, you know, just got all the facts and
get a better education that way. Because the modern day education system has pretty much dropped the ball, especially when it comes down to science.
Mm-hmm.
You can teach a kid math, and you can teach them different social things and stuff like that, which I guess maybe in the long term might be beneficial. But if you don't teach them how things work, then they got to go pay somebody who does know how they work.
Right.
That's the same thing in every industry. Don't matter whether it's the medical industry or the mechanical industry. The mechanic charges you $100 an hour for a reason. Because you don't know how to fix it. But he does.
Right. He already paid the money to go learn how to do it.
Yep. And he's going to make money because you don't know how to fix it. If you understand what we've been trying to talk about here today, then all it is, it's not rocket science, it's simple science, simple physics, and doing what nature does. And if you paid attention to nature, you walk around, if you want to know temperature differences, walk around and test them out in different places. It's obviously cooler in the shade because you're not getting bombarded with radiant energy from the sun. So there's a useful thing that you can use right there. You need a temperature difference for energy transfer, for heat transfer. So it's cooler in the shade than it is out in the air. Those two produce wind. Trees help to produce wind. Ain't that cool?
Mm-hmm.
Because of that temperature difference. Cause these little motions going on. So you ever wondered where the wind came from? It's from this ball spinning 1,000 miles an hour. my hair.
Is that what happened?
Maybe. But, you know, when it comes to mad science, if you ain't got mad science hair, you need to get it. Seriously. If everybody looks like that, then somebody will be asking why. And you say, because we know real science. And if you want to learn, step it up. Anyway, you've been listening to the Mad Science Show. Thank you, Natalie. I enjoyed sharing information with you today. Did you enjoy the show?
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Cool. Well, folks, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to get it. You need to be a mad scientist. And if you want to be a mad scientist, it's really super simple. All right, go over there to the Super Chat Room and click on the Attend the University of Mad Science button. Pass that test, print out your doggone diploma, and then you can proudly display it on your wall and in public and tell everybody you have a degree in mad science. There you go. So, peace and love, everybody. Take care. You've been listening to Mad Science. Stay tuned for the music with Kara Auer, and then shortly after that, the Hope Show with Beverly.
Was that ant that stood up to me?
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Ooh. One ant. Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss. They're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this brain is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
Well, how about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life.
It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission:
to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch.